Mes chers collègues, la séance est ouverte. La séance est ouverte. Mes chers collègues, d'abord je voudrais, en votre nom à tous, remercier le Parlement portugais pour son accueil ici dans cette magnifique salle du Sénat portugais, qui désormais est devenue la salle de séance de l'APM, puisque les Portugais ont supprimé le Sénat, et finalement cette salle maintenant, elle peut devenir le siège itinérant de l'APM. En tout cas, je tiens à remercier José Junqueiro pour son accueil, ainsi que toute la délégation portugaise, le président du Parlement portugais, l'ensemble des services du Parlement pour leur accueil. C'est toujours un plaisir pour chacun, et je me fais l'interprète de tous les membres présents à Lisbonne, pour dire que c'est un vrai plaisir que d'être dans la capitale du Portugal, qui est une ville absolument magnifique, et notre regret à tous, c'est d'être obligé d'en partir si vite, parce qu'on n'aura pas le temps de voir tous les charmes de la capitale portugaise. Et en même temps, c'est une ville qui est à la fois méditerranéenne et au bord de l'Atlantique, comme l'est le Portugal, mais profondément méditerranéenne par ses attaches culturelles, bien évidemment. Et donc, nous sommes heureux de pouvoir aller d'un bout à l'autre de cette Méditerranée, de voir tous ces pays qui sont à la fois si différents et si proches. Alors, Monsieur le Président de la délégation, merci de votre accueil. Je ne vais pas être plus long parce que je vais vous passer tout de suite la parole pour ouvrir les travaux de la commission pour lesquels nous sommes venus. Nous avons un ordre du jour très chargé pendant ces quelques jours passés à Lisbonne. Cet après-midi, à nouveau des réunions de commission, puis réunion du bureau. Nous aurons le temps d'échanger beaucoup entre nous sur la situation actuelle en Méditerranée. Il se passe beaucoup de choses dans l'ère méditerranéenne à l'heure actuelle, et notre Assemblée, pendant ces dernières semaines, a eu un agenda également très chargé sur des questions essentielles, en particulier concernant le Proche-Orient. On aura l'occasion aussi d'en parler les uns et les autres et d'échanger à cette occasion. Monsieur le Président, merci, et je vous passe sans tarder la parole.
Bom dia a todos. Gostaria em primeiro lugar de saudar o nosso Presidente, o Sr. Rudi Sal, e os nossos convidados, Filipe Grandi e Jorge Vela, e também Sérgio Piazzi, o Secretário-Geral, e Ana Napoli, que fazem parte desta mesa e trabalharão connosco durante a manhã. Gostaria de vos dizer, sinceramente, que a todos os delegados, aos colegas e aos amigos que já somos e que fomos fazendo ao longo destas reuniões, que gostaria de vos dar as boas-vindas em nome do Parlamento Português e agradecer também o facto de terem aceito o convite para participar nesta reunião. É uma grande honra para o Parlamento Português tê-los aqui connosco e ter a Assembleia Parlamentar em Portugal e em Lisboa para discutirmos os temas tão importantes que nos movimentam e nos motivam durante estes anos. Durante este ano, a APM demonstrou ser uma plataforma válida para uma discussão aberta sobre as questões que são preocupações mútuas em toda a região. E os debates nas nossas reuniões mais recentes foram muito enriquecedor e as contribuições de cada um muito estimulantes, e posso dizer com orgulho que a APM está de facto a trabalhar, mas a trabalhar no terreno, dentro da realidade. As muitas recomendações e propostas que foram apresentadas para os próximos anos são uma abordagem proativa da nossa organização, condição fundamental para poder enfrentar os desafios do futuro. E antes de avançar para uma análise dos resultados dos trabalhos da primeira Comissão Permanente, à qual Portugal atualmente e desde a terceira sessão plenária do Mónaco preside, gostaria de apresentar e propor à mesa a adoção da ordem do dia para a reunião de hoje. A ordem do dia está distribuída. Pergunto se alguém tem alguma proposta de alteração ou se é aceite. Interpreto o vosso silêncio como concordância e, portanto, entraremos na ordem do dia. Muito obrigado. A primeira Comissão Permanente continuou este ano a abordar as questões relacionadas com o Médio Oriente, o terrorismo e o crime organizado. Lembrar-se-ão de que começámos em Istambul com a primeira reunião do novo grupo de reflexão, em janeiro, sobre a definição de terrorismo. Tratou-se de uma iniciativa focalizada, muito bem coordenada pela deputada Ashkin Hasan, da Turquia, e pelo deputado Tessia Kiubá, da Palestina, que se encontram também aqui entre nós. O trabalho deste grupo de reflexão foi concluído em março, em Roma, onde foram definidos um projeto de relatório e de resolução. Estou certo que os correlatores irão esta manhã apresentar-nos um quadro mais detalhado. Uma outra nota positiva relacionada com este grupo de reflexão são os ilustres oradores convidados pelo Secretariado para enriquecer a abordagem e as conclusões a que chegaram os parlamentares. Permitam-me referir que quem são e agradecer-lhes as valiosas contribuições. O Dr. Walter Guerre, chefe da primeira secção dos Serviços Legais Antiterrorismo, Divisão de Prevenção do Terrorismo, Divisão de Tratados das Nações Unidas, no Gabinete de Drogas e Crime em Viena, que apresentou uma análise do trabalho e sobre a forma como este pode auxiliar os parlamentares nas suas tarefas de legislação sobre a questão do terrorismo. O Sr. Mutlu Kocaeli, comandante do Departamento da Polícia Turca e analista internacional sobre terrorismo, que se centrou nas medidas que a Turquia tem tomado na luta contra o terrorismo. O Sr. Seda Rassini, professor associado e diretor da Organização de Investigação da Estratégia Internacional na Turquia, que discursou sobre o impacto da retórica e terminologia da guerra na luta contra o terrorismo. E o Sr. Mahmoud Ayub, coordenador residente das Nações Unidas em Ankara, que fez uma apresentação mais pessoal, também centrada sobre as causas da raiz do terrorismo. Fomos em seguida para o Cairo, onde tivemos a primeira reunião do novo Grupo Especial de Trabalho sobre Crime Organizado, dirigido pela deputada Angela Napoli como relatora. Estamos todos conscientes da forma como esta questão afeta indiscriminadamente os países das costas do Norte e Sul do Mediterrâneo e, assim, o crime organizado, como constatamos, não conhece fronteiras e temos de estar atentos para evitar qualquer tentativa de esta doença se espalhar por todos os níveis da sociedade. Nós, como parlamentares, temos um papel especial a desempenhar na luta contra o crime organizado e, por essa razão, a APM considerou que não devíamos menosprezar esta questão, que abrange pequenos crimes locais, assim como atividades criminais internacionais de âmbito alargado, tais como o tráfico de droga, armas, pessoas e obras de arte e o branqueamento de capitais que afetam profundamente a economia mundial e as nossas economias. Em relação a essa reunião no Cairo, gostaria de agradecer ao Parlamento Egípcio e ao Sr. Deputado Mohamed Aboulanin a calorosa recepção e a organização excelente com que nos acolheu a todos nós. O principal orador desse Grupo Especial de Trabalho foi o famoso arqueólogo Dr. Zay Awas, secretário-geral do Conselho Supremo das Antiguidades Egípcias, que discursou sobre o tráfico de obras de arte e artefactos e apresentou o trabalho que ele e a sua equipa têm levado a cabo no Egito para recuperar artefactos roubados por indivíduos do Egito e do estrangeiro. O tráfico de artefactos antigos tem sido e ainda é uma questão muito problemática, colocando a Grécia, a Itália e o Egito no centro dessa questão, representando também um negócio lucrativo. O Médio Oriente continua a ser uma prioridade da APM este ano, sobretudo após a escalada da violência entre Israel e a Palestina no final do ano. Gostaria de abrir um parênteses sobre esta questão para informar que a APM recebeu o reconhecimento de muitos países e de fóruns internacionais pela condenação imediata das consequências do conflito armado e pelo envio a todas as delegações, membros das Nações Unidas, de apelos de ajuda humanitária às populações civis afetadas. Isto mostra como é importante para a APM a existência de uma comissão ad hoc, contínua, dedicada especificamente ao Médio Oriente. Em nome da Comissão Permanente, gostaria de agradecer ao deputado Jorge Vela a sua dedicação a esta questão, como presidente da Comissão ad hoc. O deputado Vela também representou a APM na reunião internacional das Nações Unidas em apoio da paz israelo-palestiniana em maio, no Chipre, onde discursou sobre o que os parlamentares podem fazer para contribuir para o processo de paz no Médio Oriente. Estou confiante de que nos apresentará uma análise clara da missão bem-sucedida de uma delegação de alto nível da APM ao Médio Oriente, liderada pelo nosso presidente, o deputado Rudi Sal. Esta missão foi planeada no início do ano para ter lugar imediatamente após a operação militar israelita em Gaza. Todavia, por motivos de segurança, fomos aconselhados por intervenientes na região a adiar essa missão para uma data posterior. Mais tarde, mas ainda hoje, o Dr. Sérgio Piazzi, o nosso secretário-geral, irá fazer uma comunicação sobre a representação da APM em reuniões regionais e internacionais. Este é um ponto importante à medida que a APM cresce e ganha visibilidade e credibilidade a nível regional e em todo o cenário internacional. Antes de concluir esta breve introdução, gostaria de agradecer em primeiro lugar aos relatores e correlatores dos grupos de trabalho, assim como aos parlamentares que participaram de forma ativa nas reuniões organizadas em diferentes locais. E a este propósito, gostaria também de agradecer aos parlamentos organizadores a sua inexcessível hospitalidade. O valor do nosso trabalho está relacionado com a partilha de experiências e melhores práticas nacionais, pessoais, profissionais, académicas e técnicas. Isto significa que estamos não só interessados em ouvir e refletir, mas também em oferecer a nossa plataforma a outras partes interessadas nas questões que abordamos. A capacidade das pessoas, das organizações internacionais e da sociedade civil, diretamente envolvidas no tratamento e na resolução dos principais assuntos preocupantes, constituem um excelente e indispensável elo de ligação na nossa cadeia de pensamento e visão. Tenho assim a honra de convidar o Sr. Filipe Grandi, que vem de Jerusalém. O Sr. Filipe Grandi é Comissário-Geral e pertence à Agência das Nações Unidas para os Refugiados da Palestina no Próximo Oriente. Irá falar-nos sobre o trabalho da sua agência e, possivelmente, sobre algumas sugestões para ações futuras da nossa Assembleia para apoiar o processo de paz. Após o discurso do Sr. Grandi, seguir-se-á uma sessão de perguntas e respostas e estou confiante de que aproveitarão esta oportunidade para colocar as vossas questões a este nosso distinto convidado. Sendo certo também que tivemos o cuidado de fazer uma gravação áudio e vídeo que de todos os trabalhos durante estes 3 dias, que depois vos enviaremos para a nossa memória e para constar, digamos, dos nossos arquivos no futuro. Muito obrigado a todos. O Sr. Filipe Grandi tem a palavra.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Thank you, everybody, for inviting me as a guest speaker this morning. In particular, my thanks and the thanks of the Commissioner General of UNRWA, Mrs. Karen Abu Zeid, go to the President of the Standing Committee, Mr. Junquero, and to my old friend, the Secretary General, Sergio Piazzi. I am glad that you invited UNRWA to this session on political and security-related cooperation. And indeed, I think the word guest speaker is very appropriate to define the presence of an agency like ours in this assembly. We are indeed guests if you discuss politics and security, but indeed we are a guest with very much to say. I know that later on today you will discuss the Middle East, and I am aware, of course, that some of you visited recently the region and met with my colleagues, especially in Gaza. What I intend to do briefly this morning is to talk about the challenges that my agency, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, the challenges that we face, and I hope that by talking about our challenges, you will have yet another perspective on the problems that you will discuss, and that it will remind you that it is important, not that you need to be reminded, but it is important to hear the voices of the people that we work for, the Palestine refugees that have been dispossessed now for 60 years. As everywhere, unless a situation of displacement, especially massive displacement like that of Palestine refugees, unless these situations are resolved, peace cannot be attained in the context of a comprehensive agreement. But before, let me say a few words about the agency that I represent. This is an agency which is not very well known even within the United Nations system. And to give you a sense of our operation, let me tell you, we are 60 years old. In fact, this year we observe more than celebrate. There's nothing to celebrate, but we observe our 60th anniversary. We were created by a General Assembly resolution in 1949. We serve a population of over 4.5 million people, the Palestine refugees, that is, those who fled the territory of British-mandated Palestine in 1948-1949, and their descendants. We serve this population in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan, and in the occupied Palestinian territory. Part of these 4.5 million people live in what are called refugee camps. They are really by now refugee townships. There's 58 of them throughout the Middle East. But the majority of the refugees, by now, after 60 years, live outside these camps. We provide public services. Essentially, we are an agency that provides, quite independently from the respective governments, education, health, preventive and curative, services to the poor, poverty alleviation activities, and a microfinance service. In situations of conflict, like in Gaza, for example, or in the past sometimes in Lebanon or in the West Bank, we also provide, of course, humanitarian services. Just to give you a sense, we run about 700 schools, and about 500,000 Palestinian children attend UNRWA schools in the Near East. So we are a little parallel authority, if you wish, in matters of social interest. We run about 130 health centers, and through our regular and emergency activities, we feed more than 1.2 million people. We're not purely a humanitarian agency, and we are not, like most others, agencies in the United Nations system, we're not an agency providing technical assistance to governments. We work directly with the people that we serve. We have about 30,000 staff, most of them Palestinians, most of them refugees themselves, and most of them teachers. 20,000 of them are teachers, but also health and social workers and other staff. There's very few international staff working in this agency. So it is a very peculiar organization within the UN system. We define our work as a work of human development because we work directly with people for their human development. And of course, in a troubled region, in a region prone to, in many different ways, fundamentalist and extremist temptations, we are also, especially through our large education program, a vehicle to convey United Nations values. We're quite used to work in conflict. Since 1949, I've been trying to count the number of conflicts in which our agency has been caught in, but it's too long. The list is too long to share. However, the situation prevailing in the last 2-3 years is perhaps one of the most complex and complicated which the agency has had to face. The combination of active conflict, of political crisis, and in respect of the agency, and I'll mention this later, of funding difficulties, makes this one of the most difficult contexts, especially in some areas like in Palestine, one of the most difficult contexts and one of the most difficult situations that the United Nations has to deal with worldwide. The situation is most acute, of course, in what we call our emergency areas of operation: Lebanon, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and Gaza. In Lebanon, we serve officially 400,000 refugees, although the number is probably lower by at least a fourth. A number of them, a minority in fact, but a substantial number, live in 12 very complicated and difficult refugee camps. And the history of Palestine refugees in Lebanon, as many of you know, is a difficult and complicated history, is a history of exclusion due to historical reason, the involvement in the civil war, the fragmentation of the state, and especially during the war period. This has affected greatly the living situation of the Palestine refugees. It has excluded them from many categories of employment, and it has created very bad living conditions, especially in the camps. However, since 2005-2006, the government, the outgoing government of Prime Minister Siniora, very courageously has recognized, in the context of a normalization of relations with the Palestine Liberation Organization, has recognized that it was important to address some of these acute social and humanitarian problem of the refugees. And we have started, in coordination with the government, some important programs to relieve the situation. This, of course, has been made extremely difficult by the Israel-Hezbollah war in 2006, by the terrible, if small, conflict in the north of Lebanon in 2007, when a group of militant anti-government armed people took refuge in one of the camps, and the camps ended up being completely destroyed, and of course the 2008 political crisis. Now, the recent elections bode well, we hope, for the future, so there is again a window of opportunities in Lebanon to restart some of the key activities that we had agreed with the outgoing government to undertake. In particular, what is very urgent is the reconstruction of the Nahr el-Barid refugee camp. This is a camp, just to give you an idea, of 30,000 people, which was destroyed in 2007 during the conflict. People have been living in a state of displacement since then, so refugees that are doubly displaced, if you wish. And UNRWA has the primary task, together with others, of reconstructing the camp. This is like reconstructing a town of 30,000 people. This is a challenge less known than that of Gaza, than those of Gaza, but indeed an important challenge for which we need support, especially if the situation in Lebanon continues to progress positively. The largest challenges, of course, that we face are in the occupied Palestinian territory. I'll remind you that refugees constitute 30% of the population of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and 70% of the population in Gaza. UNRWA, therefore, through its services, has a very large and prominent task to carry out, especially in Gaza, where all other service providers are unable to function at the moment. However, the combination of scarce resources on our side, of the hardships of occupation and of conflict, including inter-Palestinian conflict, makes the task extremely difficult. In the West Bank, for 2.5 million Palestinians, their own land is a land of obstacles. The occupation, to continue to be sustained, needs a very complex structure. And this structure is also put in place and kept in place, obviously, to defend a network, a system of settlements, which, as you all know, are recognized as illegal under international law. I think most of you, especially those of you who have visited there, are aware of the very complicated panoply of obstacles that are put, that are established in the West Bank. Not only the wall, the separation wall, but also the checkpoints, the fences, the roadblocks, the earth mounds. The United Nations estimate that there's about 600 or more than 600 of them in place. This is a system aimed at separating Palestinians from Israeli settlers living in the West Bank, but also has the effect of separating Palestinians from Palestinians, Palestinians from their own businesses, Palestinians from the services that they have to have access to, from their own land. And this affects every aspect of their life. Selling produce, learning in schools, getting treated in health centers, praying at churches and mosques. This is especially acute, as you know, in East Jerusalem, where a campaign of demolition and expropriation has been going on and has been exacerbated in recent weeks. But UNRWA as well, our own agency, is affected in our own work. Our people, our more than 6,000 staff working in the West Bank have a lot of difficulties, you know, for teachers going to schools or for doctors going to the health centers to treat patients. We have a lot of difficulty accessing isolated communities as well. But what is most striking, if you talk to any of our thousands of staff working in the West Bank, is to witness every day the profound humiliation inflicted on people through the control system. A humiliation which, I don't need to tell you, can only breed hatred. And hatred, I don't need to tell you, can only breed further violence, even of the worst kind. The situation in Gaza, and I was talking to the president a few minutes ago because he just visited, and I really want to commend this assembly for having fielded this courageous mission. The situation in Gaza is difficult to imagine if you have not seen it. This is a city of 1.5 million people trapped in a siege and caught, on top of that, in an inter-Palestinian conflict. In a city of 1.5 million, just to give you some Mediterranean examples, you know, this is Marseille or Barcelona urban areas. This is a very, very large population we're talking about. This is not a small town in a remote corner of the Mediterranean. And like in the West Bank, the configuration, the construction of the siege is very complex and sophisticated. And a few data, just to remind you. We estimate that to keep things going at the bare minimum, you need to bring in 500 trucks of different things into Gaza every day, between the agencies working there and the private sector. At the moment, the average of the last few weeks is 75. There is only one small crossing point that all of us, including the private sector, can use regularly. And that's called Kerem Shalom, and it is very difficult to operate. We operate it almost manually, without equipment. That's all we can do. All the other crossing points, including the crossing point of Rafah, which leads into Egypt, are closed most of the time. Rafah is open for acute medical cases and other special cases or delegations like yours. In practice, the only things that can go inside Gaza are products that are destined for acute humanitarian situations, medicines and food. All the rest cannot go. There is no, of course, no air access. And movement on the seafront is restricted to almost nothing. I remind you that according to the Oslo Agreement, there would have to be a temporary allowance for fishermen to move on a radius of 20 nautical miles. And this is hardly ever achieved. The consequences on the population are brutal. The private sector has collapsed. According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, which is a very serious and professional organization, about the unemployment has reached 46%, one of the highest in the world. And this affects in particular youth. So you have a huge, more than 50%, very young people, most of them teenagers, most of them boys, who are idle in the street. I think you're having a discussion on terrorism and organized crime, and I hope you can join all these dotted lines later on in your discussion. 80% of the population depend on humanitarian aid. The water and sewage networks are crumbling. The sewage is actually pumped into the Mediterranean raw without treatment. Fuel is in chronic shortage, and the treatment of acute patients abroad depend on the whims of the openings and closings of the crossing point. The situation has been like this, more or less, since 2006, since the election, since the choice made by the international community, and I'm talking about the international community almost in its totality, to adopt a stance of not talking to Hamas, which is the de facto government in Gaza. It worsened very much in 2007, and worsened dramatically just before, during, and after the war that raged in December and January in Gaza. You know the details of that war, the killing of 1,400 people, of whom 300-400 children, the damages or the destruction inflicted to more than 50,000 houses, and the destruction inflicted also on most other public structures, including some of the United Nations structures, including our own central warehouse in Gaza, which was burned completely to the ground on the 15th of January. There was huge outcry, a huge international humanitarian effort on the part of everybody, Western donors, Arab donors, international donors, culminating in the Sharm el-Sheikh conference, in which almost or maybe more than $5 billion U.S. dollars were pledged for the reconstruction of Gaza. Nothing of that reconstruction has occurred because nothing which is necessary for that reconstruction is allowed to cross into Gaza. I won't recite to you the list of authorized and non-authorized products because it simply makes no sense. But what is the most serious is the fact that the materials and equipment for reconstruction are not allowed in. Now, what does this whole thing mean? What it means is that Gaza is kept alive through a careful dosage of humanitarian aid. But economical and physical reconstruction are forbidden. This, of course, fuels the illegal economy, the economy that still takes advantage of the remaining tunnels, those that were not destroyed during the war. It also does not manage to support the forces in Gaza, and they are still the majority, that support peace, that are against the reckless and criminal shooting of rockets over southern Israel. There are forces that are against it, but the blockade does not help these forces. Largely these forces are, or for example, these forces are the representatives of the private sector that for years has conducted business
with Israeli businesses and now cannot do this anymore. In parentheses, one of the main destructions that happened during the war was that of the small but active industrial zone of Gaza that was completely flattened out by the bombardments. So the forces of moderation are not allowed to operate. I just close here because the facts speak by themselves. I close here on Gaza saying, you know, as the agency that is the only viable remaining service provider in Gaza, and as the agency that has the responsibility, socially speaking, for 70% of the population, we're duty-bound to tell you that since the ceasefire on the 18th of January, and despite much talk, nothing has progressed in the Gaza Strip. These are the difficult situations in which we work. Some signs of hope, especially in Lebanon, but many, many elements of concern, especially in Palestine. You may think that, because all of this, of course, is a result of the stagnation of the peace process, you may think that at least UNRWA, the agency providing this neutral and civilian services, that this agency is supported. Well, we get good support from the donors. You know, we are an agency funded almost exclusively by voluntary contributions of donors. And yet, this is not quite enough. Because the population grows, because we have to pay salaries to our 30,000 staff, which are calculated by comparison with the corresponding government salaries, we have a budgetary structure which is difficult for donors to match. And every year we have a shortfall of about 20% in our budget, in our regular budget, which does not allow us to invest sufficiently in the quality of our program. This year we have an even worse shortfall that affects our operative budget. We are struggling, I'll tell you very honestly and openly, to find the money to pay the last 6 weeks of salaries this year. We don't have it yet, and we are already almost in July. This is dangerous, of course, because the decline in the quality of our program affects in particular young people, children in our school, and the majority of the population, which is a young population, contributing to the sentiment of disaffection and frustration that we have described above. Now, this, of course, poses an additional burden on those host governments hosting refugees, that commendably, since 60 years, are providing excellent services themselves to refugees and are helping us take care of the refugees. And I'm talking in particular of the governments of Jordan and of the government of Syria. But our financial crisis affects them as well, poses an additional burden on their own already stretched structure, and risks causing social instability, which would be very catastrophic in either country. Looking ahead and making some proposals to you. Well, clearly all these issues have only one solution or way forward, which is to make progress, restart, I would even say, the political process, especially, or the political processes in the Middle East, but in particular, the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, of course, like everybody, we have shared some sense of expectation following President Obama's historic speech in Cairo a few days ago. In spite of the skepticism and lingering pessimism of many, including many of the people with whom we work daily. It takes more than a speech to restore their confidence in this peace process. We're not a political actor. We depend on political action, but we're not a political actor. We, on our side, are committed to fulfill our role of providing humanitarian assistance if there is conflict, and to provide opportunities in the social sectors that I have described. We are also trying to modernize and reform our organization and to make it more open to partnerships, but especially more effective in providing services. In short, we intend to continue to be, to the extent possible, a factor of social stability in the Middle East and a partner for peacemakers. But what can you do?
This is a difficult question. I have been reading about your activities, interesting activities, and I think, and again, let me speak from a non-political perspective, but I think that much can be achieved in this situation through what I think you call parliamentary diplomacy, one of the goals of your own existence. Your own governments have almost all of them much clout on one or the other or both parties to the crucial conflict. And your constituencies are also very much influential and very much listened to in the Middle East. So I would say, both for your governments and your constituencies, keep them well informed. This is one of the most talked about and least known conflicts in recent history. Keep them correctly informed about the situation and mobilize them when it is possible to do so. The first area, I think, on which everybody should focus is, of course, to restart the peace process, because without that, nothing else would work. And I hope that it is very clear to everybody that we are entering perhaps a period of favorable circumstances internationally. It can also be a last significant chance to solve the problem, at least to solve it rapidly. But this means much political pressure on the actors of this process, on the government of Israel and on the Palestinian Authority and on all other stakeholders. And I think it means also, forgive me if I venture into political territory here, it means also supporting very laudable, commendable Egyptian efforts to bring Palestinian factions again together in reconciliation and unity. Because without that, any meaningful talk will be impossible. And we see it even in our daily work. My second area of recommendation is perhaps something that you will think a bit academic, but we think it's important. Those of you who have been in Gaza will understand what I say. I think it's important to remind the parties to this conflict that international law must be observed. In the recent conflict, and let me tell you, I have worked in many bad situations around the world in my over 20 years with the United Nations. But the violations of international law that we have seen in the recent conflict in Gaza on both sides have been flagrant, have been really astonishing. Reminding all parties of the importance of respecting international law is of paramount importance. Well, first of all, because we cannot exclude further conflict, and the respect of international law is aimed first and foremost at protecting civilians during conflict. Second, it is important that you are vocal about this as parliamentarians and that your governments are vocal as well, because we have to impress on everybody in the region, especially on young people, that the rule of law is stronger than the rule of the gun. Otherwise, the temptation of the rule of the gun will be stronger than the attraction of the rule of the law. It is also important to be vocal, frankly speaking, to restore a very shattered credibility of the international community with the common men and common women in the street in the Middle East. They don't believe any more that the international community is fair and impartial in dealing with this conflict. And advocating for respect for the international law is one way to try and restore this credibility in Gaza, in southern Israel, in the West Bank and elsewhere. The third area is, of course, to address the constraints of access in West Bank and Gaza. Of course, this depends ultimately on peace, but I don't think we should see this simply in this sequence, that first comes peace and then access is lifted. Lifting at least some of the access restrictions can create a climate which can foster the achievement of peace.
And there is much that can be done to address this problem. And of course, improving access will mean improved living conditions for the people trapped, especially for those trapped in the siege of Gaza or trapped in the obstacles of the West Bank. It will reinforce those who have a stake in peace as opposed to the others. It will solidify a very shaken social fabric. Nowadays, who is more attractive to a young Palestinian in Gaza? His family and their traditional and solid values, or those that want to lure him towards armed action? This is an important question that you should ask yourself. But improving living conditions, giving dignity back to fathers, as some of us always say, is an important part of the action to be taken. Fourth, if the peace agenda gets a new lease on life, with the new attitude of the U.S. administration in particular, and of the international community, it is very, very important that we all remember that the refugee issue should remain on that agenda, and should remain in that agenda with a just solution in sight, as is enshrined in numerous United Nations resolutions. And it is important to remember that the wishes of refugees must be heard when a solution is sought, because ultimately it will be the refugees themselves that will be the judges of whether any solution found to their problems is just or not. And last but not least, please support UNRWA. If I can make a self-serving appeal here. This agency cannot be allowed to fail or to recede, because for millions in the Middle East, we are a visible sign, a tangible sign of concern by the international community. Talk to your governments about this. You know, I'll be frank with you. Governments in this region are not, except rare and sporadic occasions, are not among the best and most regular and most generous donors to UNRWA. More can be done, and you have a role to play in this until a solution is found, and then UNRWA ceases to be necessary. I will conclude to you speaking as a citizen myself of this region that you represent. I think nowhere more than in this region, in our region, does this conflict resonate for a variety of links and synergies, not only because geography puts us very close to this conflict, but also because of history and politics and economics and culture. And the people that we serve, that my agency is honored to serve, the Palestine refugees, the long-suffering people that we serve, send you a message today that now is the time for action, and now there is an opportunity. But if this opportunity is wasted, those who do not want peace in all camps will prevail. And it will take very long to reassemble the positive conditions that seem to prevail again today. Too long, for sure, for any of us in this room to ever see peace in the Middle East. Thank you, Mr. President.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Grandi. Este foi uma intervenção extraordinariamente importante, muito esclarecedora, e suponho que não vão faltar questões para colocar ao nosso convidado. Por isso, sugeria as vossas inscrições, sugeria que fosse, enfim, 2 minutos para haver o maior número possível de participantes e para termos depois uma resposta global. Mas antes disso, eu daria a palavra ao nosso Presidente da Comissão.
Obrigado. Mes chers collègues, je voudrais d'abord remercier Monsieur Grandi pour l'exposé tout à fait remarquable qu'il a fait devant nous, et je voudrais en profiter pour rendre compte de la mission que nous avons effectuée il y a un mois et demi au Proche-Orient. Je vous rappelle que dès le mois de janvier, notre Assemblée avait tenu à réagir de façon très forte et très claire après et pendant les événements de Gaza.
Nous nous sommes donc rendus il y a un mois et demi dans une tournée au Proche-Orient qui était importante, qui nous a amenés d'abord au Caire, puis à Gaza, puis à Amman, ensuite à Ramallah, pour terminer à Jérusalem. Et j'étais allé moi-même d'ailleurs personnellement également à Damas. Je dois dire que il est important de pouvoir parler de Gaza une fois qu'on est allé à Gaza. C'est très difficile de parler de Gaza quand on ne connaît pas Gaza. On peut en parler, on peut toujours se faire une idée, mais l'idée est évidemment beaucoup plus précise quand on est allé sur place et qu'on a vu. C'était la première fois pour ma part que je me rendais, et je crois que c'était aussi la première fois pour l'ensemble de la délégation du bureau qui s'y rendait. Mon impression a été double. Première impression, c'est la misère, la pauvreté, l'enfermement qui rend la situation absolument insupportable. Et la deuxième impression, c'est la richesse de Gaza. On n'est pas dans un désert, c'est une terre fertile, il y a un bord de mer, on peut faire donc de l'agriculture, de la pêche, on pourrait même y faire du tourisme. C'est une région qui n'a pas de raison objective d'être pauvre. Et ce qui est d'ailleurs très frappant, c'est que d'un côté et de l'autre de la frontière, on a deux mondes. Et la situation d'enfermement à laquelle on assiste à l'heure actuelle, et M. Grandi a eu raison de dire que, en dehors des vivres et des médicaments, qui eux effectivement arrivent, il n'y a pas il n'y a pas de problème de ce côté-là. Et l'action qui est faite par l'UNRWA est absolument remarquable. Je tiens encore, à travers M. Grandi, à féliciter toute l'équipe de l'UNRWA qui travaille et qui fait un travail remarquable. Mais on voit bien que cette situation engendre de la violence, engendre des réactions extrêmement vives, peut même susciter des réactions au-delà de la violence, le terrorisme et autres, parce qu'on est dans une situation absolument insupportable. Et donc, notre sentiment, c'est qu'il faut très vite arriver à trouver une solution politique pour sortir de cette situation qui ne peut pas durer. C'est la raison pour laquelle, évidemment, nous demandons de la façon la plus urgente la création d'un État palestinien viable, dans des frontières reconnues, qui puisse cohabiter aux côtés d'Israël et qui puisse disposer des atouts d'un État et notamment de la liberté d'aller et venir. Parce que si Gaza est complètement fermé, lorsqu'on va à Ramallah, évidemment on peut sortir et aller à Jéricho, aller dans d'autres villes, mais il y a à chaque fois des checkpoints qui rendent les déplacements extrêmement difficiles, insupportables pour la population, et cela non plus n'est pas acceptable. Ce que nous remarquons aussi, c'est que dans le même temps, jamais la communauté internationale n'a été aussi unie sur la situation palestinienne. Aujourd'hui, il y a unité de vue entre les États-Unis d'Amérique, entre l'Europe, entre les grandes puissances du monde, l'ensemble des États européens, en disant « il faut aller vite ». Et d'ailleurs, les engagements, les déclarations faites par le président Obama au Caire sont particulièrement claires sur ce sujet. Et ce qui est encourageant, c'est que la présidence américaine a placé ce sujet en début de mandat et non pas à la fin du mandat comme d'autres présidents avaient eu tendance à le faire. Donc, ça veut dire que c'est une priorité et c'est important de le souligner. Donc, jamais l'opinion internationale a été aussi favorable à un règlement politique de la situation, et jamais, malheureusement, les deux parties en présence n'ont été aussi éloignées. La situation politique en Israël, à l'issue des élections, les déclarations du ministre des Affaires étrangères, Lieberman, sur ce sujet, les déclarations également du Premier ministre, qui, sous la pression tout de même des autres nations, a commencé à évoluer. Le discours de Benjamin Netanyahou d'il y a 15 jours n'est pas exactement la même que celle d'il y a 2 ou 3 mois. Donc là aussi, il faut quand même regarder ça de très près. Et dans le même temps, la situation palestinienne, désolante aussi, parce que aujourd'hui la Palestine est divisée et qu'il y a d'une part des gens qui souhaitent effectivement un règlement politique, qui agissent en ce sens-là, qui sont prêts au dialogue, et puis d'un autre côté le Hamas qui pour l'instant ne répond pas à cette invitation, et cette division du peuple palestinien n'est pas bonne pour défendre notamment la cause palestinienne. Donc, je crois que vous avez raison, M. Grandi, de dire que la diplomatie parlementaire et le Parlement de la Méditerranée a son rôle à jouer. Nous avons été portés un certain nombre de messages au Proche-Orient et je souhaite que nous puissions œuvrer dans le sens d'un règlement politique, parce que nous ne croyons qu'au règlement politique. Et nous ne pensons pas que la force ou la violence puisse amener quelque chose de positif dans la région. Donc le règlement politique, il est évidemment l'affaire des États, mais il est aussi l'affaire des parlements, parce que nous représentons les sociétés civiles et que nous pouvons faire passer un certain nombre de messages qui apportent un peu de l'eau au moulin au règlement politique de la situation. En tout cas, notre visite à Gaza et à Ramallah a apporté beaucoup à notre délégation, à renforcer notre détermination à lutter pour parvenir non seulement à un règlement politique, mais à la création d'un État palestinien, qui est évidemment une demande totalement légitime de la part du peuple palestinien, qui doit être prise en compte, qui doit enfin trouver un aboutissement, et que nous puissions arriver à créer les conditions d'une paix durable au Proche-Orient. Enfin, je terminerai là-dessus, un certain nombre d'entre nous sont des Européens, méditerranéens, mais Européens. Je rappelle régulièrement aux belligérants qui se trouvent au Proche-Orient, et je le dis aussi bien aux Palestiniens qu'aux Israéliens, nous nous sommes battus pendant très longtemps en Europe, les uns contre les autres, pour des frontières qui aujourd'hui n'existent plus. Et ceux qui étaient les ennemis d'hier sont devenus aujourd'hui les meilleurs amis. Et c'est la raison pour laquelle, partant du principe qu'on ne peut faire la paix qu'avec ses ennemis, je pense que nous avons là non pas une leçon à tirer, et je ne dis pas non plus que l'Europe doit être un exemple à suivre. Je dis que simplement il y a là une piste à explorer, parce que si un jour une union du Proche-Orient pouvait se créer, nous pouvons toujours rêver, mais la politique s'est faite aussi à partir de rêves qui peuvent parfois se réaliser. On aurait là une des régions à la fois les plus riches et les plus heureuses du monde, et nous savons bien que l'équilibre du Proche-Orient est très important aussi pour l'équilibre du monde. C'est la raison pour laquelle les efforts que nous avons entrepris au sein de l'Assemblée parlementaire de la Méditerranée doivent être poursuivis, et nous devons œuvrer pour arriver à ce que les Palestiniens puissent enfin disposer d'un État et que nous arrivions à tracer la voie d'une paix durable au Proche-Orient, puisque je crois tel est le souhait de l'ensemble des parlementaires qui sont ici présents et ou représentés au sein de l'Assemblée parlementaire de la Méditerranée.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Rodizal. Vou dar a palavra ao Messias Mahmoud. Ei, Messias, ok.
Bismillah. Shukran, Sayyid al-Rais. Shukran lil-Portugal. برلمانا وحكومة وشعبا. شكرا للبرتغال التي يلثم بحرها المحيط. شكرا للبرتغال التي تحتضن إقليم الأندلس. بداية أود أن ينقل استهجاني لسلوك دولة عضو في هذه الجمعية أوقفت منح جنسية لامرأة لأنها ترتدي الحجاب. ومن صميم عملنا هو حوار الحضارات واحترام الثقافات. ذلك لأن الحضارة ليست ملكا لشعب، والثقافة ليست وقفا على أمة من الأمم. ذكرتم يا سعادة رئيس الجلسة أن مؤتمر القاهرة أقر بإعادة الآثار المسروقة وحرض عليها، ونسيتم آثار العراق التي يبلغ عمرها 8000 عام، والتي سرقت بعد دخول القوات التحالف إلى بغداد. كما نسيتم المخطوطات السورية التي تجاوزت 5 ملايين مخطوطة وموزعة في شتى أنحاء العالم، ومعظمها في متحف اللوفر في باريس. أما الرجل الفاضل المحترم الأخ جراند ممثل الأونروا فشكرا له، وأقترح أن يعطى العضوية الفخرية في هذه الجمعية، ذلك لأنه جاء لنا بإضاءات عز مثيلها، فهو يعيش في الميدان ويتنسم أخبار الجبهة، ونحن في العربية نقول لا يعرف الشوق إلا من يكابده، ولا الصبابة إلا من يعانيها. يقول الأخ المحترم جراند أن عمر الأنوروا يساوي 60 عاما، ولم نعرف في كثير من المحافل. إن هذه المنظمة التي تقوم بالدور الإنساني الجبار والجهد الطيب لا تعرف هيئات الأمم، فما الذي هو تعرفه هذه الأيام؟ ذكرتم الأخ جراند بأن الفلسطينيين تركوا بلادهم في عهد الانتداب. هنا أود أن أختلف معكم، لم يترك الفلسطينيون بلادهم في عهد الانتداب، تركوها بضغط الآلة العسكرية الإسرائيلية في الحروب العربية الإسرائيلية المتوالية بدءا من عام 48 و56 و67 وحتى يومنا الحالي، وأنتم عانيتم من هذا الأمر، وقلتم أيضا إن السنتين الأخيرتين هي من السنوات العجاف أي الصعبة. حقيقة يعاني الفلسطينيون منذ عام 1948، منذ عهد بالفرع في 22/2/1917، ومن اتفاقية سايكس بيكو عام 19. كما قلتم أن في لبنان 400,000 لاجئ فلسطيني دمرت معظم مخيماتهم. كما تمنى الأخ جراند أن تفعل الدبلوماسية البرلمانية فعلها في تقريب وجهات النظر، وأنا أسأل هل تستطيع الدبلوماسية البرلمانية الناعمة أن تقوم بدور أفضل أمام دولة رفضت أكثر من 40 قرارا من مجلس الأمن وأكثر من 80 قرارا من هيئة الأمم؟ شكرا لكم والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Muito obrigado, o senhor Suleiman.
شكرا سيد الرئيس. ما كنت أنوي أن أتحدث في بعض منه تحدث به زميلي الدكتور محمود، لكنني يوم غدا سيكون لنا حديث أطول. وبنفس الوقت أريد أن أشكر السيد أندرا ممثل الأونروا على حديثه الواضح الشفاف النقي الذي حقيقة لم أسمع مثيلا له من قبل مسؤول في هيئة الأمم حتى هذه اللحظة، فشكرا لك يا سيد أندرو على وضوحك. ولا بد لي أن أتذكر موقفا أثناء زيارتنا إلى غزة ولقائنا مع المواطنين في غزة ومشاهدتنا للبيوت المدمرة والأطفال المشردين والعائلات المحروقة والبيوت المحروقة والمزروعات التالفة. أتذكر من أجل الإنسانية ومن أجل كل الأحرار موقفا شاهدته من زميلنا السيد جورج فيلا من مالطا، عندما لموقف إنساني تأثرت بموقفه عندما دخل خيمة بها مجموعة من الأطفال والنساء حاولوا أن يعملوا أو يقدموا له القهوة على النار، فلاحظت منه موقفا إنسانيا أنحني إكبارا لك يا سيد فيلا على ذاك الموقف. شكرا. تريدونني أن أوضح موقف السيد جورج فيلا؟ لقد بكى السيد جورج فيلا عندما شاهد جرائم الإسرائيلية في غزة على أرض الواقع. شكرا.
Obrigado, Monsieur Fedala.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. شكرا سيد الرئيس. شكرا لدولة البرتغال على الاستضافة الطيبة وما تقدمه للوفود المشاركة من كلمات طيبة ووسائل مادية تجعلنا فرحة تامة ونشعر بالاطمئنان. من واجب سيد الرئيس أن أتوجه بكلمة شكر كذلك للسيد المحاضر جراندي على الموضوعية المطلقة، على المهنية الكبيرة، على النزاهة التي تحل بها وهو ينقل لنا وقائع مرة كنا نشاهدها على الشاشة ونتألم من مشاهدتها، لكن اليوم نتألم أكثر عندما ينقلها لنا خبير مهني أمضى سنينا من عمره في القيام بنبل المهام وهي مهمة الاستغاثة لشعوب تموت وتزال من الخريطة على المباشر. لقد خلصتم سيدي إلى كلمة وقلتم من خلالها لابد من إعادة النظر في عملية السلام، ونفهم من هذا أن الهيئات والدول التي ترعى عملية السلام وتشرف عليها قد فشلت في مهمتها، ويعني هذا من باب المنطق أننا نعود إلى نقطة الانطلاق وهي نقطة الصفر. هل هذا هو الحل أيها الإخوة والأخوات الحاضرين في هذه القاعة؟ هل نملك الإمكانيات أن نضغط نحن على الدول الكبرى، الدول القوية التي ترعى عملية السلام هذه؟ وسؤالي يبقى مطروح للنقاش، وشكرا لكم مرة أخرى سيدي.
Monsieur Cuba, s'il vous plaît. Bonjour.
شكرا سيد الرئيس. بداية أتوجه باسم الوفد الفلسطيني بالشكر الجزيل إلى البرتغال حكومة وشعب وبرلمانا على الاستضافة وحسن التنظيم والإدارة، متمنيا قريبا أن يأتي اليوم أن نستضيفكم في فلسطين كدولة فلسطينية مستقلة في القدس إن شاء الله. سيد الرئيس، بالواقع أنا يعني متابع مش كليا جزئيا نشاط هذه الوكالة العظيمة اليونروا، ولكنني اليوم أتقدم بالشكر الجزيل والتقدير العالي لهذا التقرير الذي اعتبره ممتازا للسيد جراندي، والذي يصف بموجز بعض مآسي الشعب الفلسطيني سواء في أرض الوطن أو في الشتات، في غزة أو الضفة أو لبنان أو سوريا والأردن وإلى آخرهم بلاد الشتات. هذا الشعب على طيلة سنوات التشرد الإجباري يعاني كل ما ذكره السيد جراندي وأكثر وأكثر من ذلك. وألف شكر لجراندي، متمنيا له النجاح ولنا جميعا بالعمل لحث حكوماتنا على بقاء اليونروا حي وتقدم الخدمات للشعب الفلسطيني، الخدمات التعليمية والصحية والاجتماعية إلى آخره. وبالواقع في ظل حصار غزة في هذا الظرف الحالي تلعب اليونروا دورا رائدا، وليس بالغريب أن الجيش الإسرائيلي وحكومة إسرائيل أمرت بضرب مستودعات اليونروا ومدارس اليونروا ومستشفيات اليونروا. وأنا سأقترح هناك اجتماع لمكتب الرئاسي سيبحث لمن يعطي الجوائز هذا العام، وعندي اقتراح محدد في هذا الصدد. سيد الرئيس، أيضا لابد أن أتقدم بالشكر للسيد سال رئيس الجمعية والوفد المرافق اللي زار الشرق الأوسط وزار فلسطين غزة لعدة ساعات، أقل من 5 ساعات، وزار رام الله لعدة ساعات رغم هذه الساعات القليلة جدا بالنسبة لي. أستمع اليوم إلى الكلام السيد سال وأستشف من كلماته هذا التعاطف الكبير مع الشعب الفلسطيني واعترافه بضرورة حل الدولتين، دولة فلسطينية مستقلة وعاصمتها القدس ودولة إسرائيلية. وتمنى سال أن تزال الحدود مستقبلا مثل ما أزيلت تقريبا حدود في أوروبا. أنا مع سال، ومنذ الآن باسم شعبنا الفلسطيني نقبل بدولة فلسطينية واحدة بغض النظر عن الدين أو الجنس أو العرق أو اللغة، دولة بشرط الديمقراطية تسع للجميع. وقتها ما عندنا مشكلة يطرح يعني ليبرمان تهجير فلسطينيين 48 مليون وربع مليون فلسطيني من الجليل، ولا سنطرح نحن إزالة المستوطنات. دولة للجميع، ديمقراطية، الوطن للجميع والدين لله في هذا الجانب، ونحن على استعداد. وهناك دول الآن، وبالفعل أوروبا نموذج إن في هذا الجانب، فنحن مستعدين لحل الدولتين، لحل دولة، لأننا نريد حلا، نحن نريد السلام. وقدمنا سيد الرئيس تنازلات كبيرة جدا من أجل السلام. لقد اعترفنا في أوسلو أن إسرائيل تملك 78% من أرض فلسطين التاريخية، ونحن وخيرة المناطق اللي على البحر والساحل، ونحن 22% على رؤوس الجبال والصحراء. وبالرغم من ذلك يقبل علينا أن نفاوض منذ 16 عاما، ويأتي نهاية نتنياهو يطرح علينا يجب أن نعترف في دولة يهودية، ولازم تكون دولة يهودية نقية، يعني نطرد الفلسطينيين والشركس والدروز، وإذا واحد أصله كردي يطلع. وهذه دولة يهودية نقية عنصرية، وأيضا يشترط أنه غير مسلحة، الهوى مش إلها والأرض مش إلها، الأجواء مش إلها والأرض مش إلها. وضع شروط اللي بكل صراحة لا ولن ولم ولا وكلا أن نقبل بها. نحن شعب صحيح صغير، صحيح مشتت، صحيح محكوم من عدة دول، لكن لن نقبل بأقل من دولة فلسطينية مستقلة ذات سيادة وعاصمة القدس وحق اللاجئين بالعودة. ومش مشكلة بالنسبة لنا، حتى أكون صريح، احنا زملاء وعدنا كذا سنة نعمل مع بعض، وبالتالي أنا لن أخدعكم. وأتكلم بالنيابة عن المجلس الوطني عن القيادة الفلسطينية. احنا عندنا صلاحية بكل صراحة، احنا لن نتعب ولن نكل. 10، 20، 50، 100 عام، لكن لن نتنازل عن حق من حقوق. وكفى كفى 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 التنازل الهائل اما قدمنا 78% من ارض فلسطين التاريخية لاسرائيل. ازود من هذا التنازل لا يمكن. وبنصحكم لا تسمعوا لاي فلسطيني قائد مش قائد انه مستعد للتنازل. لا يستطيع اي فلسطيني اي جهة فلسطينية ان تتنازل اكثر من ذلك. صحيح ميزان القوى مش لمصلحتنا، لكن هذا مش للابد. لن يبقى الوضع المحيط خليني اسميه احسن ما يزعلوا مني بعض العرب كما هو. تتغير الظروف، تتغير التكنولوجيا، تتغير المعادلات، وبالتالي السلام مثل ما هي مصلحة فلسطينية هي مصلحة إسرائيلية، ويجب على قادة إسرائيل أن يكونوا بعيدين النظر وينظروا في السلام والأمن لأطفالهم زي أطفال فلسطين. نحن نريد أن نعيش ونحب الحياة، نريد أن المسرح والدبكة والرقص والموسيقى وتطور العلوم والثقافة، ولا نريد السلاح والتطور السلاح والنووي وغير النووي وصريخ بعيد المدى وقصير المدى. لكن إذا ما في هذا الخيار أقفل في وجهنا، وقتها الأجيال ستحدد الأسلوب والطريقة لتحصيل حقوق. كلمة أخيرة لشركائنا الأوروبيين، نحن يعني شعوب المتوسط شمال وجنوب تعلمنا عبر التاريخ من بعضنا البعض، فكانت هناك في حضارة عربية وفي حضارة يونانية وغريقية وتبادلنا. هذه الحضارة امتنزج يعني مع بعضها البعض، واحنا يعني صرنا نتغنى بحقوق الانسان ونشبه بدنا حقوق انسان في بلادنا العربية مثل اوروبا، وبدنا ديمقراطية مثل اوروبا. وبالفعل معجبين بحقوق الانسان في اوروبا، لكن السؤال الكبير اللي دائما في ذهننا، ليش حقوق الإنسان في أوروبا نقطة ووقفوا عندها بينما بتجاهلوا حقوق الإنسان في فلسطين؟ وعندما يحاولوا أن يذكروا كلمة، يعني يذكروا كلمة عربي وبهدلوا العربي وإلى آخره، لكن يحذرون جدا أن يذكروا كلمة يهودي أو إسرائيل. يعني مثل التقارير وبجيلها في نقاش بعد الظهر انه النزاع الاسرائيلي الفلسطيني في غزة، هذا نزاع؟ هذا وصف نزاع؟ بدي كلكم وتفاجئوا، هذا وصف هولوكوست. هولوكوست اللي عملته اسرائيل في غزة وهي متعودة ان تعمله في السابق في كفر قاسم ودير ياسين وكذا وكذا وكذا. في هذا الموضوع لماذا تترددون في التعبير عن الأشياء بواقعها وبحجمها ومسمياتها في هذا المجال؟ أنا أقول إذا كانت البامب تريد، وكان هذا حلمي وأملي منذ البداية، أن تلعب دور رائد ليس في القضية الفلسطينية، في برنامجها كبامب يجب أن تميز نفسها عن الجمعيات البرلمانية التقليدية اللي بتقول كل كلمتك وامشي في هالموضوع. نحن يجب أن نحدد المسؤولية على هذا الطرف أو ذاك، ولسنا وزارة خارجية. لسنا وزارة خارجية. أنا بشكر ثانية الواب وبقول إذا 10 ساعات رجع بهذا الانطباع، كيف للمواطن اللي عايش هناك؟ شو شعوره؟ كيف بده يكون عايش بشكل طبيعي في هذا الجانب؟ هل قدر سيرجو انه لو عايش في غزة كيف وضعه؟ او السيد الرئيس او اي عضو من الاعضاء؟ او كان هذا الجدار وهذه الحواجز؟ ارجو من شركائنا الاوروبيين ان ينصفوا الشعب الفلسطيني ولو مرة واحدة. وشكرا سيد الرئيس.
Obrigado, Sr. Cová. Madame Canolo Pulo, da Grécia.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Permettez-moi tout d'abord aussi de remercier le Parlement portugais pour son accueil et pour l'excellente organisation de cette réunion de la commission, des commissions de la femme, de féliciter les rapporteurs et de remercier tout particulièrement Monsieur Grandi pour ces informations si touchantes et révoltantes. J'ai pris la parole parce que je voulais encore une fois saluer l'initiative de la PAM au Moyen-Orient, que je juge extrêmement importante. Je crois qu'on va en reparler tout à l'heure à l'occasion du rapport de M. Bell, mais j'aimerais déjà en parler maintenant. Saluer cette initiative de la PAM, je crois qu'elle a un côté extrêmement important, tout d'abord de renforcer le rôle politique de notre Assemblée, qui n'a pas été mise en valeur jusqu'à présent. Et d'autre part, d'agir envers ce problème du Moyen-Orient d'un côté tout à fait différent, je dirais presque de l'intérieur, d'agir en tant que Méditerranéen, en tant que gens qui font partie de la région, et d'agir avec une diplomatie parlementaire, c'est-à-dire une diplomatie au niveau des peuples, une diplomatie qui touche les gens tout particulièrement et qui utilise surtout le dialogue. Et j'insiste sur cette nécessité du dialogue, sur la nécessité d'informer, la nécessité de mobiliser nos gouvernements, de rappeler à tous l'importance du respect des lois internationales et enfin de restituer la confiance à la communauté internationale. Je crois d'ailleurs que la communauté internationale et tout particulièrement l'Europe, dans le cadre d'une diplomatie de prévention des crises, aurait pu profiter de la trêve, aurait pu profiter de cette trêve qui était une réalité pour agir auprès des parties en question, bien entendu envers Israël, envers l'autorité palestinienne, mais aussi d'une manière ou d'une autre, même envers Hamas. Je crois qu'il faut instituer de nouveau ce dialogue envers tous les côtés. D'ailleurs, je ne sais pas très bien où se trouvent les limites du terrorisme, parce que l'OLP dans les années 70 était aussi considéré comme un mouvement terroriste. Mais progressivement, le dialogue a été établi avec elle. Il a abouti à la reconnaissance réciproque entre l'OLP et Israël. Et cela a abouti aux accords d'Oslo, qui étaient en soi une ouverture et une réalité, qui s'est traduit avec un dialogue entre l'autorité palestinienne et Israël. Et en 2006, la communauté internationale, et l'Europe en particulier, a permis l'organisation d'élections qui étaient des élections tout à fait démocratiques et avec l'élection de Hamas dans la bande de Gaza. Je crois donc qu'il faut restituer le dialogue vers tous les côtés. Et aujourd'hui, évidemment, la question qui se pose est est-ce que cette solution des deux États est-elle possible? La solution des États auxquels je crois profondément. Il suffit de visiter la Cisjordanie pour voir à quel point le gouvernement israélien successif, avec leur politique de peuplement, de construction des colonies, ont fait ce qu'ils pouvaient pour la rendre pratiquement impossible. En outre, il y a aussi de l'autre côté l'incapacité des Palestiniens à trouver un accord entre les différentes parties et à contrôler leur violence, ce qui a conduit d'ailleurs au résultat des élections israéliennes. Mais je crois quand même qu'Israël a su conquérir et coloniser. Et il s'est montré aussi capable s'il a su conquérir et coloniser, il s'est aussi montré capable de se retirer dans les territoires occupés, comme dans le Sinaï ou dans la bande de Gaza. Bref, je crois que même si c'est difficile, il faut œuvrer envers cette solution, la solution des deux États. Et j'aimerais conclure en parlant de nouveau du rôle joué par la PAM, que je crois extrêmement important, parce que c'est de nouveau, je dirais, un rôle au niveau des peuples de la Méditerranée, et je crois qu'on doit agir tous envers ce sens. Merci.
Obrigado. Madame Chiari, s'il vous plaît.
Merci. Bien évidemment, je m'associe aux propos de tous nos collègues pour vous remercier pour votre accueil, M. Junqueiro, et l'accueil du Parlement portugais. Je remercie aussi M. Grandi pour la qualité de son exposé. Alors, M. Grandi, vous avez exposé, vous avez évoqué les humiliations qui sont les germes de la haine, et je ne puis que partager avec vous cela, et la nécessaire réhabilitation du rôle des pères. Alors, toutes les difficultés que vous avez évoquées m'invitent à vous poser des questions sur la situation des femmes. On sait que le plus souvent, elles sont les piliers, qu'elles transmettent les valeurs et qu'elles gèrent le plus souvent, malheureusement, la pénurie. Et nous observons une certaine radicalisation religieuse qui pèse plus fortement sur les femmes. Alors, est-ce que vous constatez une dégradation de leurs conditions de vie? Et est-ce que votre agence a un programme spécifique pour les femmes? Mon deuxième point vient parce que j'ai entendu, je voudrais réagir à ce que j'ai entendu, car un collègue a mis en cause la France dans le cadre d'une décision de justice. Alors, ce que je voulais lui dire, c'est que la France est un pays qui est exemplaire en matière de droit d'asile, que la machine à intégrer fonctionne toujours. Ma présence au nom de la France en qualité de parlementaire en témoigne. L'intégration d'un certain nombre de ministres au sein du gouvernement d'origine étrangère témoigne de cette intégration. Je voulais aussi dire que la justice dans notre pays est indépendante et que d'autres pays ne motivent pas pour refuser la nationalité quand elle est demandée. Et dans ce cas d'espèce, la justice a eu des éléments qui ont concouru à ce qu'elle se détermine en conscience pour considérer que ce cas était incompatible avec nos principes républicains et la laïcité qui est la matrice qui surplombe nos identités plurielles. Alors je pense que la France n'a pas à rougir de son bilan en matière de droits de l'homme. Bien évidemment, tout est perfectible et ça peut toujours l'être. Et sans faire injure à personne, ce bilan peut se comparer favorablement à beaucoup de pays. Voilà, je vous remercie.
Obrigada, Madame Oudah da Tunísia. E é a última questão.
شكرا سيدي رئيس الجلسة. أريد في البداية أن أتقدم بخالص عبارات الإعجاب والشكر والتقدير لممثل لونروا السيد غراندي على العمل الإنساني والراقي والنبيل الذي يقوم به في هذه المنطقة منطقة المتوسط في هذه الظروف الصعبة وصعبة جدا. أريد أيضا أن أعبر على قلقنا نحن كبلدان عربية على السياسة التي تنتهجها اليوم إسرائيل، سياسة التطرف، السياسة التي لا تعترف بالدولة الفلسطينية قائمة الذات والتي ماضية قدما في الاستيطان. وأريد أيضا أن أقول أنه ما حدث في غزة، وأنا أشكر الجمعية التي استطاعت أن تواكب عن كثب ماذا حدث بالفعل في غزة، أن أقول أن ما حدث في غزة هي إذا وصفت هذه الأشياء فإنها حروب ضد الإنسانية بالوصف القانوني لذلك تلك الجريمة. وأقول أننا علينا كلنا عرب واتحاد أوروبي ومنظمات إقليمية ومنظمات عربية أن نعمل كلنا على أولا كما قال السيد ممثل لونروا غراندي أن نوحد أولا الصف الفلسطيني، فإذا واصل الصف الفلسطيني في الانشقاق فإن عملية السلام ستكون عملية صعبة وصعبة جدا. الشيء الثاني كما قلت على المنظمات ونحن نعول على الاتحاد الأوروبي لأن معظم البلدان العربية في شراكة متفاعلة مع الاتحاد الأوروبي على الاتحاد الأوروبي أن يخرج من الجمود وأن يكون أكثر معناتها عمل وجهد ونحن رأينا أن في خطاب أوباما هنالك بصيص أمل كبير بأن تكون هنالك إقامة دولة فلسطينية وأريد أن تكون الاتحاد الأوروبي والجمعيات المنظمات العربية أن تعمل بتفاعل حتى نستطيع أن نحقق هذا الأمل وهو إقامة دولة عربية. وسؤالي أتماشى مع زميلتي من فرنسا ما هو وضع المرأة الفلسطينية في فلسطين وفي خارج فلسطين وشكرا.
Obrigado, senhor Amoroso.
Grazie, presidente. Ringraziamo l'Assemblea del Portogallo per questa squisita accoglienza e in modo particolare ringraziamo anche il signor Filippo Grandi per il suo rapporto e per la sua relazione. Un rapporto molto chiaro, molto determinato, che fotografa in maniera molto precisa quella che è una situazione, ma che non si ferma, io penso, a questo. Esso mira e ha un obiettivo ben preciso, che è quello di creare un percorso che riporti la pace nel Medio Oriente. E procedere in questo percorso è possibile se tutti quanti ci predisponiamo ad essere disponibili. Che cosa vuol dire? Vuol dire essere disponibili, vuol dire capire, comprendere, rispettare tutti quanti, anche gli altri. E questo anche nel momento, ad esempio, dell'episodio che si è richiamato poco fa, relativo alla Francia, dove un paese deve essere rispettato per quella che è la sua storia, la sua tradizione, quelle che sono le sue leggi e quindi da parte di chiunque vi è il diritto di rispettare anche queste leggi. Se mancano questi presupposti io penso che sia molto difficile poi poter procedere in un percorso di pace. Ma il dato importante che emerge oggi è anche quello che ormai la convinzione che l'obiettivo di uno Stato palestinese autonomo e indipendente sia ormai accettato da tutti, almeno da questa Assemblea, da quelli che sono gli Stati che in essa intervengono. Non dobbiamo dimenticare che anche durante la sua ultima visita a Gerusalemme anche Sua Santità ha espresso questo pensiero e questa aspirazione a vedere realizzare uno Stato autonomo indipendente della Palestina. E quindi in questa direzione anche le osservazioni da parte del signor Grandi sulla necessità di un'unità del mondo palestinese chiaramente vanno in quella direzione. Ecco, allora io penso che in questo momento questa nostra Assemblea può assumere e svolgere un ruolo molto importante se sappiamo e dobbiamo capire più che, diciamo, continuamente denunciare, creare anche le condizioni che accanto a queste giuste e legittime denunce ci sia una volontà di costruire, di andare avanti, di procedere in un percorso. E io penso che l'ultima visita, alla quale purtroppo nessuno della delegazione italiana ha potuto partecipare, alla striscia di Gaza, sia stato un esempio di come questa Assemblea voglia direttamente sul posto, capendone i bisogni, capendone le necessità, intervenire per poi superare questo aspetto e creare quelle condizioni utili a poter creare appunto quel percorso di pace che è l'obiettivo finale a cui tutti dobbiamo tendere. Grazie.
Muito bem, eu vou dar agora a palavra ao Sr. Grandi para poder fazer umas considerações globais, mas antes gostaria de dizer ao meu amigo Mahmouda que ouvi as suas referências. Este documento não é exaustivo, não estão esquecidas as obras do Iraque ou os manuscritos da Síria, apenas não é exaustivo, isso é reconhecido. E relativamente à questão de um estrangeiro que tem dificuldades de entrada, Nós agora só estamos a ver se existe já neste momento alguma questão e agradecíamos é que se pudesse depois precisar particularmente ou o nome ou o país de origem para nós, junto do próprio Ministério dos Negócios Estrangeiros, sabermos o que é que se passa para podermos ajudar. Senhor Grandi, se faz favor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do not have much to add because you have very effectively complemented and completed my presentation. I would like, nevertheless, to thank all of you for all of the speakers for the expressions of appreciation and support that you have manifested. It matters a lot for us who are working on the front lines, as has been mentioned, to know that important constituencies that you represent in this region know what we do and support us. I think an important question, perhaps the only real question for me that was formulated was that about women. And je vais vous répondre en français, madame. C'est une très bonne question, je pense, et c'est une question importante. Et, au-delà des considérations politiques, il est vrai, par exemple, qu'à Gaza, la situation des femmes s'empire, devient plus difficile, disons. Mais la raison principale pour l'accroissement des difficultés de la situation des femmes réside dans la pauvreté. Dans des situations de pauvreté croissante, et c'est la situation qui prévaut dans les territoires palestiniens, surtout en ce qui concerne les réfugiés, c'est les femmes qui sont touchées d'abord. Donc c'est dans ce domaine qu'il faut agir pour essayer d'améliorer leur situation. Et vous avez posé la question très légitime, si notre agence a des programmes pour améliorer la condition des femmes, oui, elle a des programmes importants sur lesquels nous mettons l'accent de plus en plus, parce que nous, dans une situation de financement telle que je l'ai décrite, donc très critique, nous devons nous focaliser essentiellement sur les groupes les plus vulnérables. Et malheureusement, dans beaucoup de cas, c'est les femmes qui font partie de ces groupes, surtout les femmes avec des grandes familles, surtout les femmes avec des nombreuses familles, surtout les femmes qui ont perdu leur mari, ce qui est un cas très fréquent dans les situations de conflit au Liban, par exemple, ou dans les territoires. Je souhaiterais que vous puissiez visiter la bande de Gaza et de voir, et si vous le faites encore, j'aimerais vous offrir la possibilité de visiter nos programmes pour les femmes à Gaza. Nous avons des programmes assez extraordinaires et une participation active et parfois très courageuse de la part des femmes. Donc la réponse est oui, et merci pour avoir posé cette importante question, parce que finalement, vous le savez mieux que moi, dans un processus de paix, c'est les femmes qui vont jouer un rôle très très important pour pousser le processus de paix et pour la reconstruction qui suit tout accord de paix. There was another very important question on whether parliamentary diplomacy will work. I think it was a member of the Jordanian parliament that asked this question. Well, I should ask you this question. You should not ask me this question. But my instinctive reply is that I don't know if it will be the only means to achieve peace, certainly not, but it will be an important contribution. You all know better than me that peace will require a great deal of political courage by all governments concerned in the region and also the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government. Internal political courage to push the necessary compromises that will be on the road for peace. Now, you can mobilize international public opinion in support of that and to give confidence to this government that will have to make difficult decisions. That's one of the many aspects in which I think parliamentary diplomacy can be useful. And the Israeli government, the Palestinian Authority, are very sensitive to public opinion among donor countries in the Arab region. This is your public opinion. This is the public opinion that you represent. That's why it is important that you mobilize it. And if I can conclude by saying that We really need your support. I hope that in your deliberations today you can express explicitly the need to support these efforts. Come and visit again. I'm not just addressing myself to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Mediterranean, but to you as individual parliamentarians and to your colleagues in Parliament. We host many parliamentary delegations in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan as well, and we have seen an increase in these delegation visits, including by the U.S. Congress. And we think that this has really contributed a lot to shift some of the perceptions. So come again, you'll be most welcome. And finally, the last point I want to stress, I hope that my presentation today has helped at least give you one more element, as I said in the beginning. This is a political problem. You are a political body. But this is also, and very much so, a human problem. I think some of you have stressed that, and the visit to the house and the emotion that is caused. This is a human problem. It's a problem that we have been dealing with for 60 years at the human level. And we should not forget that. So I appreciate very much the statement of Mr. Kuba that concessions are difficult. But Mr. Kuba, I hope that it will not take another 100 years to reach peace, because this will be another 4 or 5 generations people dispossessed, your people dispossessed and deprived of their basic rights. This is not just a political issue, this is an issue that concerns men and women, real as you and us are. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado mais uma vez, Sr. Grandi. O elevado número de intervenções testemunhou o interesse desta intervenção e a participação e passaríamos de imediato, até porque estamos um bocadinho atrasados, à apresentação e discussão dos projetos de relatório e resoluções, agradecendo, como é óbvio, aos relatores e aos co-relatores pelo seu trabalho e também a todas as delegações que quiseram fazer sugestões e alterações aos nossos projetos de relatório. Assim, convidava de imediato o Sr. Jorge Vela, Presidente da Comissão Ad-Hoc para o Medio Oriente, para tomar a palavra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, good morning to all my colleagues. And let me also thank the Portuguese host for putting at our disposal such august surroundings where we will have our discussions in these coming days. I will present a report on the mission of the Middle East, but as you can see, we have already gone deep into the question of the Middle East this morning with the excellent report of Mr. Grandi, for whom I don't find enough adjectives with which to congratulate him for his excellent objective presentation, his hands-on experience, his wise recommendations, and the intelligent reflections on the state of play in Gaza. I can say a priori that the mission, the visit to Gaza, was an enriching experience to all of us, as also said by President Sall, both politically and spiritually. And as I can admit that it led to a lot of reflection from my side. The mission took place between the 18th and 21st of May and was organized by the PEM Secretariat with the aid and support of the Egyptian and Jordanian parliaments, the United Nations and French diplomatic authorities. The trip was carried out over 4 days in 4 countries, and we visited Egypt, the occupied Palestinian territories, Israel and Jordan, and had meetings with major actors on the regional scene. What were the objectives of this visit? The objectives were, first of all, to give tangible proof of our genuine concern and selfless interest in the problems of the Middle East, in particular, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the human suffering it has brought along in its wake over the years. Second objective was to acquire hands-on experience of the situation, and then, on the experience gained, consider how best PAM could promote peace and stability in the region. We wanted also to carry out a fact-finding mission on the consequences of Israeli military operations in Gaza, the cost-led operation, which took place from 27 December 2008 up to the 18th of January 2009. We wanted, as PAM, to express solidarity to the aggrieved people of Gaza and to the families of all those hit by any military action, be they Israeli or Palestinian. We wanted to convey the message that we do care about what is going on and about what has been going on in the Middle East as it impinges directly on the security of our region. We wanted to present PAM as a responsible, trustworthy parliamentary forum to different actors in the region, especially parliamentarians and parliamentary assemblies, in order to establish regular contacts and open channels of communication which could be used profitably in a constructive way in the future. And also, we wanted to re-establish dialogue with the Knesset so that it resumes active participation within PAM. I will just go through the main points which came out of the meetings with the eminent personalities which we met during our visit, starting with Dr. Ahmed Fathi Surur, who was president of the People's Assembly in Egypt. We talked about the difference between PEM and DEMPA. We talked about the objectives of the PEM Bureau mission. And he briefed us about the situation in Gaza, which he called, rightly so, a real Holocaust. He also opined that war crimes that happened should be judged before International Criminal Court. And when he spoke to us about Egypt's relations with the Knesset, that his personal relations with the Speaker of the Knesset, he said that they were in agreement on commemorating the Holocaust, the historical Holocaust. But then he said that he got from the Speaker of the Knesset the impression that they wanted to concentrate all attention and efforts on Iran as a threat to the security in the area, while President Surur believed that the priority should be the resolution, first and foremost, of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As regards the peace process, he said that this is a very difficult situation, that is the issue of the future of Palestine, and also the continuation of the settlement program. And he obviously asked us to put pressures on our respective governments to see that this stops. Then we had a meeting with the Foreign Minister of Egypt, Ahmed Abul Gait, who briefed us in very much, in a lot of detail about the crisis in the Middle East, and he said that certain countries are perceived by Egypt as destabilizing the region. These countries benefit from the current crisis by supporting Hezbollah and Lebanon in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. And then he gave us his own interpretation of the situation in Gaza, and he said that Egypt could not officially recognize the Hamas government in Gaza for fear of creating two Palestinian authorities. As regards their unwillingness to open the Rafah border between Gaza and Egypt, he said that the Egyptian authorities do not consider it possible to open the Rafah terminal completely because they would risk thus allowing Hamas elements to enter on Egyptian territory and potentially threaten the internal stability of the country, and also rendering Egypt directly responsible for the situation in Gaza. He said that under the circumstances, Egypt was doing its utmost, and he then briefed us in a lot of detail about the inter-Palestinian dialogue which was taking place under the aegis of Egypt. And he said that the first people to suffer from the Palestinian division were the Palestinians themselves. And it was giving an excuse to the Israeli government to affirm that there was no valid partner on the other side with whom to negotiate for peace. Foreign Minister told us that discussions were focusing on three main subjects. First of all, the electoral system, which will be used in the July 2010 elections. Hamas wanted a proportional ballot, whereas Fatah wanted a majority ballot. The second point was the composition of the police force. Third point was the creation of an authority responsible for the temporary management of Palestinian affairs, and also things which are concerned with the creation of a new government in Palestine. Then we had a meeting with the Deputy Secretary General of the League of Arab States. He briefed us about the Arab Peace Initiative, and he asked us to be supportive of the roadmap adopted in 2003 by the Quartet, and also the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, which was launched by the Arab League. He said that obviously they are in favor of the return of Israel to the boundaries of June 4, 1967, including the Golan Heights, and they called for the application of United Nations Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, as well as the creation of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital, and the solution to the problem of Palestinian refugees as crucial to the solution of the problem. He spoke about the role that he expected to see from the United States and Europe, and he said that there were high expectations because of the new approach by the new American administration, and was also critical of the silence of the European Union during the aggression in Gaza, and also underlined the disturbing behavior of the exec presidency when he proposed the collaboration and relation for collaboration, that relations between the European Union and Israel be upgraded when all this was happening in Gaza. The Arab League, we were informed, will participate at the forthcoming plenary session in Istanbul of our conference with the presence of Dr. Amer Moussa. Then we moved into the occupied territories in Gaza. This was the most important part of our delegation, of our mission. The delegation entered Gaza through the Rafah terminal and was greeted by representatives of the United Nations. It visited an area that had been destroyed, Zaytuna, and met with Palestinians living there amongst the rubble and destruction of houses, mosques, and small industrial complexes. The delegation noticed the widespread destruction and the appalling conditions in which homeless people in this region were living, in makeshift sheds and all sorts of tents with no sanitary facilities and no running water. The delegation was briefed about many children who had fallen ill or being killed by bullets, bombs, shrapnel, or falling masonry, and heard stories from and were shown photographs by Palestinians who had lost family members in the raids, or of cases where whole families had been wiped out. Driving through southern Gaza territory, United Nations provided four-wheelers, one could see that many areas were simply unskated. Don't imagine that all of Gaza has been destructed. On the screens, you'll be seeing photos of what you know. These were taken by me when we were in this area, and they show some of them show the settlements in Jerusalem, about which I'll speak later on, and the situation in Gaza when we visited the bombed territory. In the center areas, it seems as if life went on as usual, with children walking home from school during the midday break. However, evidence of mortar fire on buildings could be seen at regular intervals in all areas along the route. Delegates were also told that whole tracts of cultivated land had been purposely bombed and destroyed, crops and agricultural production. Then we were taken to see the Jordanian Military Hospital, about which Mr. Grande didn't mention, but it's worth mentioning, because it is, we went there with the Commissioner General of UNRWA, and I can say that the Jordanian Military Hospital is a Jordanian initiative whereby a largish building was in a few months expertly converted into a general hospital, staffed by highly qualified Jordanian physicians and surgeons, providing more than just basic hospital services, with the provision of all emergency and planned services in the medical, surgical, and gynecological fields, and all necessary equipment as one would expect to find in any modern regional hospital. To many Palestinians to whom we spoke, showed great appreciation for the sterling services provided by the Jordanian medical staff. Incidentally, I have to point out also that an interesting report drawn up by independent personalities for the Arab League gives much detail about what happened even in the Zaytuna area, and with sordid details of what the Palestinians in Gaza saw the Israeli soldiers do to their families, and also with clear evidence of the use of white phosphorus bombs. Then we had a briefing, a very interesting meeting. We had Mr. Grande this morning, but we had an equally interesting meeting with Commissioner General of UNRWA, Mrs. Karen Abdelzaid, and she spoke practically in terms of Mr. Grande about the situation in Gaza, and I will not waste time to repeat what he has said, because I cannot definitely make a better presentation than he did. However, UNRWA is trying to loosen the tight controls on the borders to allow building equipment to pass through the through into Gaza for the gradual reconstruction, and also to authorize and allow larger money transfers into Gaza interior. Today, $13.5 million enter per month, but that is only enough to pay the salaries of the United Nations staff. All the money that has been promised in the donors' conference, that's about $4.5 to $5 billion, are in frozen accounts and cannot reach Gaza to benefit the stricken population. And then there is obviously a dearth of liquidity, which will definitely work against the economy taking off. Then we had a meeting with the Speaker of the Chamber of Representatives of Jordan, His Excellency Mr. Abdul Hadi Mayali, who is also incidentally the President of EMPA. And we spoke about the Middle East as well, obviously, and he said, and it was a very important quote, that King Abdullah II of Jordan said that if nothing happened in 2009 to improve the situation, he was afraid that a new military confrontation could be inevitable. This wasn't very welcome news, obviously. And he also pointed out that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict had become a strategic priority for the United States from the way Obama was behaving. A very important development in this meeting with the Jordanian speaker was that the two presidents, both Mr. Roudissal, colleague Roudissal, and Mr. Majali, agreed, decided that the two assemblies should collaborate together in a structured and regular manner, because up to now we've had this, I would call, feud between EMPA and PAM, and we managed to convince each other that we have to work together so that we'll get the maximum benefit of what we're aiming to achieve. The next meeting was in Ramallah. We went to Ramallah. Obviously, the delegation could not help noting the stringent controls at roadblocks and by armed Israeli soldiers on the way to Ramallah, and the presence of the Israeli flag fluttering from all lampposts and vantage points along the whole route. We had a meeting with the new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Riyad al-Maliki, and he gave us a report on the relations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and he said that a total stop to the settlement was needed, including those presently justified by natural growth, as well as the recognition of East Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state. The destruction in Gaza was not only defensive, according to him, it was deliberately done in order to destroy the area's economic infrastructure and to drive the entire population into misery and terror, and to impede all possibilities for the creation of a Palestinian state. He described Palestinians living in Gaza as in a prison under Israeli administration. And he again reiterated that he expected a lot of change in the foreign policy of the United States. As regards the inter-Palestinian dialogue, he said that he would rather not comment and wait for the results of the meetings which are being held in Cairo with a deadline of the 7th of July. As far as Jerusalem was concerned, he said that Jerusalem was in the process of being transformed into a Jewish city, and the mayor of Jerusalem's plan was to render it completely Jewish by the year 2020. Then we had a very interesting meeting with the Palestinian Legislative Council. Obviously, we repeated what we had said, we discussed what we had said, and we emphasized the fact that time was against the Palestinians. And we were obviously made aware that Israel was finding all sorts of legislative excuses to turn Palestinians living in Jerusalem into non-permanent residents in order to expel them and prevent them from returning to their property. They talked also about the dream of Israel to link Gaza to Egypt and the West Bank to Jordan, so that they will not have any responsibility about the Palestinians. Then we had a meeting with the outgoing, I would say, Minister of Planning of the Palestinian Authority, Samir Abdallah, and he emphasized the fact that the situation in Gaza continued to deteriorate as no development project had been implemented in this region, particularly due to the total blockade imposed by Israel. And he pointed out that the Gaza Strip alone absorbs 40% of the Palestinian Authority's budget. Then we had a very interesting meeting, which I would say most of it was private, between with Ambassador Robert Seri, who's the nation's special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, who again, like Mr. Grande, has got hands-on experience of the situation, and he agreed that the Palestinian the peace process was in a state of crisis, and that the division of the Palestinians between themselves was a factor which was impeding any dialogue from starting. He quoted the Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs as saying that his country does not feel bound by Israel's obligations under international law, including the various United Nations resolutions on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Then we went to Jerusalem, and on the way to Jerusalem, the delegation had the opportunity to note the high security measures taken by the Israeli authorities, including the high concrete separation wall with watchtowers, the electrified wire fences, and innumerable roadblocks, and so on and so forth. We met the Speaker of the Knesset, Reuven Rivlin, and we spoke about the peace process, situation in the peace process. And he even at that time told us that Israel should be acknowledged as being, in essence, a Jewish state. That was something which was being already pronounced, and he was repeating it. He said that he feared the advent of Hamastan, from Hamastan, boarding Israel in the mind, justifies, and this justifies his refusal of the creation of a Palestinian state, which would constitute, according to him, a threat to Israel's security. He said that the Palestinians will have the right to manage their local administration under Israeli supervision. He said that the Palestinians are the guests of the Israelis, and on the subject of Palestinian refugees, he said that this issue cannot be on the agenda, as they are now outside of Israeli territory, and their return would threaten the very existence of Israel. Speaking on Jerusalem, he said that Jerusalem considered the holy city as a whole, as the capital of the Jewish state, and it was impossible for him to conceive of a partition, because firstly, a Palestinian state was not possible, according to him, and secondly, because according to him, Jerusalem was promised to the Jews by God himself. Then he remarked that Israel's whole history was one of settlement, and that according to him, the priority should be the question of Iran, which should be the focus of international community's attention and not the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Then we spoke obviously about the parties involved in the conflict, and he again mentioned the fact that the division between Hamas and Fatah is a valid reason for them not to begin any real dialogue with the other side. Then we had a meeting with the foreign minister of Jordan, following day, again speaking of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and he emphasized that the roadmap and the Arab peace initiatives needed to be supported. About Israel and Iran, he said that one needed to resolve the Palestinian conflict so as to remove any pretext, the inter-Palestinian conflict, any pretext for Iran to want an attack on Israel. He said that President Obama is in total disagreement with the Israeli government and hopes to resolve, first of all, the Israel-Palestinian conflict. He obviously said that he believed that peace is possible, and that Jordan could at most even agree with the proposal of the Netanyahu government on the definition of Israel as a Jewish state. However, he said that as the Hashemite kingdom is by constitution a Muslim state, but it has also religious minorities, he said it would be acceptable only if all citizens, Jewish and non-Jewish, have the same rights and duties as that and that they are guaranteed. A very interesting meeting which followed was the Palestinian National Council, where obviously our colleagues Tasser Kuba and other colleagues welcomed us, and we had a discussion about the issue. However, it was emphasized that there should be a return of refugees, a stop to the settlements and the creation of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. It was emphasized that inter-Palestinian dialogue is constant and the PNC is optimistic on its outcome because the division became apparent only recently. The situation in Jerusalem and the widespread destruction that the city is threatened with will soon render the idea of peace impossible. The PNC supports the idea of a colloquy on the situation in Jerusalem organized by PAM at the request of the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine. Now, in conclusion, I have to say what has been achieved. The primary objectives of the mission which were achieved were the fact that we now understand better in what manner PAM could support and go along with the peace process in the region. These proposals in their entirety are outlined in the resolution. We managed to observe at first hand the current situation in Gaza and the plight of the Palestinians in this region following the destruction brought about by the Israeli armed forces. We met and established regular contacts with various key players in the region with the prospect of establishing contacts and launching a process of continuous future cooperation. We reinforced PAM's role both at the political level through the various meetings conducted as well as at the local level thanks to many televised reports and interviews given by officials, by members of the Bureau during the visit. We re-established dialogue with the Knesset, which announced that it would sit again at the next PAM plenary session in Istanbul in October 2009. Besides, it has to be acknowledged that all delegates learned a lot during this mission, managed to make PAM more visible in the region, and established important personal contacts in the political sphere. During the visit, the delegation managed also to bring closer to fruition the prospect of collaboration between PAM and EMPA. It is to be noted that during all meetings, all members of the delegation underlined and emphasized the importance of unity amongst the Palestinian factions themselves. Throughout the mission, PAM made the political players we met with more aware of the tool that is regional parliamentary diplomacy and showed that they supported the quartet and Arab peace initiatives as well as new approaches for achieving peace in the region through the use of dialogue. The delegation was able to meet with high-level representatives, both legislative and executive, in addition to senior officials of international organizations. These different types of meetings confirmed the credit that the actors in the region accord to PAM and to parliamentary diplomacy in general. Although the duration of the mission and the frequency of meetings did not allow us for additional appointments with larger numbers of political players from both the Israeli and the Palestinian sides, as well as with representatives of civil society, especially in Gaza, a sense of trust in the possibilities of PAM was established. Many expectations now converge upon our assembly, which, due to its special status, has a unique role to play in the Mediterranean. In their capacity as representatives of the people of the Mediterranean, the PAM delegates must now continue their efforts with their respective governments so that political progress can be achieved. This mission by the Bureau has become part of PAM's activities to promote and support the efforts of the international community to establish peace between Israelis and Palestinians. In concluding, I have to give my thanks to Mr. Abdelaziz and Calliope Mermitki, and affectionately known as Bobby, from whose notes these reports were developed, and the PAM Secretariat, Celine, Servi, Martin McAuliffe, and all the others for cooperating. As regards the resolution, I don't think I will go through it. The reason being that you have it, you can read it, and this is an ongoing process. If we adopt this resolution today, which I think we should adopt, it will be on the proviso that changes which will happen between now and the General Assembly in October will be included, because as you know, I mean, there are daily developments. I mean, Obama spoke in Cairo, then we have the reaction of Netanyahu, and hopefully things will be moving, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So you have the resolution which practically encapsulates what we gathered from the ad hoc mission, and I'll be ready, obviously, to answer questions about it, but because of the fluidity of the situation, we will have elbow room to change it between now and the General Assembly. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado. Nós vamos muito rapidamente submeter este relatório e a resolução, digamos, a aprovação da Assembleia. A seguir, por sugestão que fiz à nossa colega Angela Napoli, iremos fazer um curto intervalo para continuarmos imediatamente a seguir os nossos trabalhos, porque, como já deram conta, houve intervenções longas e que nos demoraram algum tempo. Portanto, eu perguntava sobre o relatório, sobre o relatório e sobre a resolução, se podemos votar conjuntamente. Podemos. Portanto, alguém se opõe? Não há abstenções? Então, consideramos o relatório aprovado. Senhor Cubá... Desculpe, só há aqui uma... Só um momento, há aqui uma primeira, um primeiro pedido de palavra que eu peço seja rápido, da Jordânia, do Sr. Mahmoud. Faz favor.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Shukran, Sa'ad al-Rais. هل تريدون أن نتحدث الآن أم بعد الخروج؟ إذا كان الحديث الآن سنتحدث بالتفصيل وأحتفظ بحقي بالوقت بالرد بعد استراحة القهوة. أما إذا أردتم الآن فأنا جاهز للرد.
أسقيرا باوزا فكشة. سيو كوبا فرشور.
بعد الاستراحة؟
سيد الرئيس، من أجل الوقت ومن أجل يعني بداية بدي أشكر ثاني مرة الوفد والجهود اللي كان فيها رغم المصاعب والتعب، فألف شكر باسم شعبنا الوفد اللي زار غزة والمنطقة. التقرير عبارة عن محضر، يعني محضر شو استمعوا من اللي قابلوهم بدون أي استخلاصات. وأيضا أكبر دليل على ذلك مشروع القرار، رغم أن التقرير ومشروع القرار لم أقرأهم إلا صباح هذا اليوم، لم يصلوا إلي بالسابق. لذلك سيد الرئيس، حتى لا يطيل النقاش وأنا مستعد للنقاش، بالنسبة لمشروع القرار بطلب عدم التصويت عليه الآن وتأجيله لدورة 23 أكتوبر، لأنه عندي العديد من الملاحظات، ومبين التقرير كأن المعتدي سكان غزة على إسرائيل، يعني كذب الحقائق بشكل مش معقول. هل تريد نناقشه الآن ولا أتحفظ عليه وبنناقشه في ترك اسطنبول؟
Sr. Cubá, nós não poderíamos adiar a votação, até porque ela já aconteceu, mas os contributos, e podemos continuar a seguir ao intervalo, os contributos que tiver para dar, e uma vez que ela própria vai ser submetida em outubro ao plenário, ela aí será, digamos, objeto de conclusão. Aquilo que eu sugeria era, até porque... Há mais pessoas que pretendem dizer ou fazer um comentário, sugeria que fizéssemos um intervalo já, um intervalo de 10 minutos, e depois voltássemos aqui para continuar os nossos trabalhos.
Okay.
Os trabalhos...
But he will announce if you come.
E pedi a vossa atenção, porque nós fizemos uma proposta que procura responder às questões levantadas pela Jordânia e também pela Palestina, e a nossa sugestão foi de fazer uma pequena reunião com o Sr. Jorge Vela, o Sr. Rudi Sal e o Sr. Sanduka, e o Sr. Suleiman, uma reunião, eles estão de acordo com isso, que se fará numa outra sala, para fazerem a leitura da resolução e para a discutirem. E, portanto, nós seguiremos os nossos trabalhos normalmente seguiremos os nossos trabalhos com uma intervenção da deputada Ângela Napoli, que venha, digamos, à sua primeira reunião na Comissão Permanente, desde que se tornou, aliás, membro da delegação italiana. Desculpe.
Grazie. Anch'io.
Só um momento, o Sr. Mahmoud quer fazer um ponto de ordem. Faz favor.
ما زلت أذكر أنك وعدت بأن نناقش التقرير بعد الاستراحة مباشرة. سيد رئيس الجلسة. ما فيش ترجمة؟
A proposta que conversámos agora foi a de discutir o problema da resolução de fazer a sua leitura conjuntamente com o Sr. Suleiman, com o Sr. Sandokan, o Sr. Jorge Vela e o Sr. Rudisal, para tentar perceber quais eram, digamos, os problemas que se podem eliminar, que existem e se podem eliminar. E eles estão de acordo e iriam sair agora para fazer essa mesma discussão. E eu parti do princípio que era sobre essa matéria que o Sr. Mahmoud queria também falar. E fizemos esta sugestão porquê? Para darmos continuidade à nossa ordem de trabalhos e para permitir a intervenção da nossa colega. O que é que eu sugiro? Que se possa participar nessa reunião e possamos falar a seguir num outro momento, depois do vosso entendimento, de modo a que não prejudiquemos a nossa ordem de trabalhos e, portanto, e possamos dar início à intervenção da nossa colega.
Ana, Ana, não أتفق. نحن سنتحدث في موضوع عام يهم كل أعضاء الجمعية وليس أشخاص. لذلك أنا سأتحدث الآن عن الملاحظات الموجودة التي طرحها الأخ جورج. أنا مش متفق، أنا بدي انسحب من الجلسة.
Nós teremos essa conversa logo a seguir à revisão do texto com vós. Senhor Cuba, faz favor.
سيد الرئيس، أعتقد أن الاقتراح سليم وهذا بيخفف من عمل اللجنة، والأردن موجودة بيننا وفلسطين والرئيس ومسؤول الشرق الأوسط الصديق جورج. أنا باعتقادي ممكن يجتمعوا يطلعونا بمشروع قرار اللي خفف المهمة عنا جميعا. شكرا سيد الرئيس.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Cuba. E é isso que vai acontecer e, portanto, esta colaboração eu agradeço porque se torna indispensável para o bom andamento dos nossos trabalhos. Então, continuaria dando, com certeza, a palavra à Sra. Ângela Napoli, que, como estava a dizer, é a primeira vez que está aqui na Comissão Permanente, depois que se tornou membro da delegação italiana. E já nos fez duas comunicações sobre esta matéria. uma exaustiva investigação sobre terrorismo internacional e sobre a resposta da Itália ao terrorismo, isto em janeiro, e uma outra sobre o crime organizado no Mediterrâneo, e aconteceu isso exatamente no Cairo. E por isso gostaria de a convidar então a usar da palavra e dizer-lhe mais uma vez que é com muito gosto que a temos entre nós.
Grazie Presidente John Cairo, grazie al Parlamento del Portogallo anche per l'ospitalità che ci stanno offrendo in questi giorni a Lisbona, città meravigliosa, e grazie per aver scelto questo tema da trattare come argomento della prima commissione permanente, perché credo che sia un tema di notevole importanza, di fronte al quale la PM non può rimanere così priva di particolari interventi e di scelte anche operative. Nella relazione che lei, Presidente John Cairo, ha richiamato, fatta da me al Cairo il 2 aprile scorso, ho trattato le varie organizzazioni criminali, quelle italiane ma anche straniere, in particolare quella albanese e quelle magrebine, che fanno parte dei paesi che insistono nell'area del Mediterraneo. E alla luce di quella relazione, anche ritengo abbastanza ampia, nella quale ho ricordato i vari trattati, le varie attività di cooperazione esistenti tra i paesi in termini di criminalità organizzata, alla luce anche degli interventi che sono arrivati sia durante la trattazione del 2 aprile al Cairo, sia come suggerimenti emendativi da parte della Grecia, della Francia, del Portogallo, che ringrazio per gli stessi, ho predisposto questo progetto di relazione e la relativa risoluzione, sperando che poi naturalmente non ci si fermi qui, anche se come mi auguro verrà approvata la risoluzione stessa, ma che la PM consideri il progetto e la risoluzione come punto di partenza per un lavoro sul tema che, ribadisco, non può ritenere fuori dagli interventi la PM tutta. La criminalità organizzata rappresenta una grave minaccia per i paesi dell'area mediterranea. Il traffico di droga, armi e beni, ai quali naturalmente, tra i quali inseriamo le automobili, le sigarette, merce contraffatta ed altro, così come le altre, come la tratta degli esseri umani, il riciclaggio di denaro sporco, le nuove forme di pirateria, costituiscono ormai una cruda realtà. La criminalità organizzata si sviluppa in particolare nei paesi che registrano istituzioni giudiziarie fragili, forze dell'ordine deboli e corruzione diffusa. Se a ciò si aggiungono l'alto tasso di disoccupazione tra i giovani, le scarse opportunità economiche lecite per la popolazione, si vengono a creare i presupposti per una seria minaccia allo sviluppo e alla sicurezza nella regione. Il traffico di armi è in aumento nelle regioni in cui la situazione politica è instabile e mina ulteriormente ogni speranza di stabilità. si stima che su scala globale la criminalità organizzata controlli dal 2 al 25% del PIL mondiale, provocando forti interferenze al commercio mondiale e regionale. Nell'era post 11 settembre vi è inoltre il crescente rischio che tali attività possano finanziare reti terroristiche più ampie. Affacciandosi sul Mar Mediterraneo, l'Unione Europea con il suo benessere è diventata un polo di attrazione economica per l'immigrazione legale e clandestina, per il traffico organizzato e la tratta degli esseri umani destinati al mercato del lavoro e allo sfruttamento sessuale. Secondo un recente studio, è in forte aumento in Europa tanto la domanda di manodopera a basso costo in settori sporchi, difficili e pericolosi, quanto quella di merce a basso costo. Lo stesso dicasi per i traffici, niente domanda uguale niente traffici. L'allargamento dell'Unione Europea nel 2004 e l'ulteriore espansione dell'area Schengen rendono particolarmente difficile la tracciabilità della merce illegale, l'identificazione di coloro che risiedono illegalmente o delle vittime della tratta all'interno dell'Unione Europea una volta superati i suoi confini esterni. Per questa ragione molti dei paesi che si affacciano sul Mediterraneo, membri o non membri dell'Unione Europea, sono diventati paesi di transito per le persone e le merci nel loro percorso verso l'Europa continentale. Negli ultimi anni sono stati intensificati gli sforzi per formulare strategie di regolamentazione e repressione della criminalità organizzata e transnazionale, specialmente nell'ambito dell'Unione Europea, ed attualmente l'attenzione è rivolta in particolar modo sulla migrazione. È inoltre emersa con chiarezza la necessità di un'adeguata cooperazione di polizia doganale e giudiziaria per combattere efficacemente la criminalità organizzata. Le giuste risorse e competenze, così come un adeguato quadro legislativo, sono strumenti ritenuti indispensabili da tutti i paesi che hanno registrato una forte ondata di persone o beni illegali. Nel rapporto annuale del 2006, l'Ufficio delle Nazioni Unite per il controllo della droga e la prevenzione del crimine ha evidenziato i recenti sviluppi nell'area mediterranea. Primo, innanzitutto, l'aumento del consumo di cocaina in Europa. Il consumo percentuale di cocaina in Spagna, che si attestava al 3% della popolazione compresa tra i 15 e i 64 anni, purtroppo ha superato per la prima volta quella degli Stati Uniti. Secondo, il fenomeno di migranti clandestini di provenienza dall'Africa subsahariana, che rappresenta un serio problema umanitario. Secondo la conferenza di Wilton Park, tenutasi a Malta nel novembre del 2007, l'immigrazione clandestina rappresenterà la principale sfida dell'area mediterranea. Dalle attuali 100.000 unità all'anno si potrebbe facilmente raggiungere, almeno queste sono anche qui, devo dire purtroppo, le previsioni, il milione di unità prima del 2025. Secondo il rapporto mondiale sulle droghe del 2007, il Marocco resta uno dei principali produttori di hashish, resina di cannabis del mondo, nonostante una costante diminuzione della produzione dal 2003. Circa il 70% della cannabis venduta in Europa proviene dal Marocco. Recenti studi delle Nazioni Unite indicano che nell'ultimo decennio la criminalità organizzata si è particolarmente rafforzata nella regione dei Balcani ed in particolar modo in Albania, che potrebbe rappresentare il 40% della distribuzione di eroina nella sola Europa occidentale. Negli ultimi anni l'Albania si è trasformata da paese di origine a paese di transito per la tratta di esseri umani provenienti dall'Asia e da paesi teatro di conflitti quali ad esempio l'Afghanistan e l'Iraq. Le rotte dall'Albania riforniscono anche il commercio sessuale di donne provenienti dalla Russia e dall'Ucraina. Secondo il rapporto Europol sulla criminalità organizzata 2005, i gruppi di etnia albanese si sono evoluti trasformandosi da semplici bracci armati e veri e propri gestori della criminalità organizzata internazionale. Sono principalmente coinvolti nel narcotraffico, nella tratta di esseri umani, nello sfruttamento della prostituzione, nell'immigrazione clandestina e in ogni sorta di reati contro la proprietà. Le organizzazioni criminali rumene e bulgare si contraddistinguono per crimini che vanno dalla duplicazione di carte di credito o bancomat allo sfruttamento della prostituzione, narcotraffico, contraffazione di denaro o documenti ed ogni sorta di reati contro la proprietà, incluso il cosiddetto dirottamento di automobili, che spesso ha risvolti violenti. Le organizzazioni criminali in Turchia sono considerate molto attive, specialmente nel campo del narcotraffico. Della criminalità organizzata italiana ho già rendicontato appunto al Cairo. Non posso non richiamare il rapporto che c'è tra criminalità organizzata e il traffico d'arte di opere d'arte e reperti. Richiamo che scaturisce dalla puntuale ma nello stesso tempo anche allarmante relazione che il segretario generale del Consiglio Supremo delle Antichità Egizie, Zai Awas, ha fatto proprio ai delegati dell'APM al Cairo. E ha relazionato sul lavoro che la segreteria generale appunto del Consiglio Supremo svolge insieme al suo team in Egitto per recuperare reperti rubati da persone del luogo o da stranieri. Esistono squadre di esperti all'aeroporto e nei porti di entrata egiziani con il compito di controllare i bagagli di individui sospetti in partenza. Il team del segretario generale ha controllato un'opera, un'attività di controllo giornaliero dei siti internet per identificare eventuali reperti rubati. Collabora con case d'asta fornendo le prove del furto di reperti messi in vendita. Ha anche affermato che in Egitto è necessario disporre di più spazio per immagazzinare i reperti, più del 45% dei quali non è stato ancora etichettato o adeguatamente registrato. Ha anche lamentato l'assenza di un database per i reperti archeologici, aggiungendo che per i custodi dei siti archeologici è difficile resistere alla tentazione, quando vengono offerte loro bustarelle di gran lunga superiori agli stipendi mensili di 200 sterline egiziane. Ha anche affermato che i musei di tutto il mondo nascondono nei propri seminterrati i reperti rubati e con l'aiuto di archeologi spie operanti all'estero l'Egitto è riuscito a recuperare oltre 100 pezzi di valore, ha elogiato la collaborazione con gli USA in questo ambito. Ha descritto le disposizioni di un progetto di legge che punirebbe il furto di reperti con 25 anni di reclusione e il danneggiamento di reperti con 5 anni di reclusione. A questo proposito ha affermato che molti egiziani scavano sotto le proprie abitazioni sperando di trovare oggetti di valore e diventare ricchi. Ha affermato che il progetto di legge si ispira ad una legge italiana che prevede la condanna fino a 3 anni di carcere per chi possiede reperti rubati e ha ricordato il caso di un curatore italiano che sotto una forte pressione mediatica ha preferito restituire gli oggetti rubati piuttosto che rischiare la prigione. Ha ribadito che la pressione dei mezzi di comunicazione è uno strumento efficace per recuperare reperti, citando il caso di un museo di St. Louis negli USA che esponeva reperti archeologici egiziani rubati. dopo una conferenza del dottore Auras in una scuola della stessa città, sono crescenti le pressioni da parte dei giovani studenti e il reperto, naturalmente, in seguito a queste pressioni è stato restituito all'Egitto. Il segretario generale del Consiglio Supremo delle Antichità Egizie ha anche espresso il desiderio di ospitare al Cairo una conferenza sul tema del furto di reperti archeologici, riunendo circa 14 paesi. Ritornando alla criminalità organizzata e all'immigrazione clandestina, durante la riunione dell'APM al Cairo è stata posta l'attenzione proprio su questo tema, sottolineando l'importanza della collaborazione tra i paesi di transito e quelli di destinazione. I paesi di transito hanno espresso il desiderio di poter ricevere assistenza finanziaria e tecnica per affrontare il fenomeno e controllare la migrazione dai paesi di origine. I settori che richiedono particolare attenzione sono il traffico delle armi, il narcotraffico, il riciclaggio di denaro sporco, il traffico di organi, la contraffazione, inclusa quella delle medicine, la tratta di esseri umani e il contrabbando di persone, le reti pedofile, la riduzione in schiavitù, la criminalità cibernetica e la pirateria telematica, il contrabbando di materie fossili e nucleari e il traffico di reperti rubati. Cosa può fare l'APM in questo settore? Io ritengo davvero tante. Queste che elencherò brevemente e sinteticamente sono semplicemente degli spunti, ripeto, iniziali per il percorso che l'APM dovrà fare, a mio avviso, su questo tema. Innanzitutto creare una riduzione della domanda, cioè meno droghe, meno armi da fuoco, eccetera. Evidenziare iniziative regionali e bilaterali nel campo della cooperazione di polizia doganale e giudiziaria, promuovere uno scambio delle migliori pratiche introdotte a livello nazionale nella lotta al crimine organizzato, sostenendo soluzioni alternative e non repressive. Per alternative mi riferisco anche a soluzioni di prevenzione, preventive. Condividere i risultati delle attività intraprese dalle organizzazioni regionali e dai partenariati quale l'OSCE, l'Euromed ed altre. Sensibilizzare i parlamentari e la società civile sul costo in termini di vite umane dovuto ai traffici, all'abuso di droghe, eccetera, eventualmente organizzando in collaborazione con i parlamenti nazionali dibattiti, anche facendo partecipare agli stessi le vittime del contrabbando, del traffico di sostanze stupefacenti. Utilizzare il quadro della legge del mare per la cooperazione tra gli Stati in materia di furto e traffico di reperti, adottare una carta che dichiari che tutto ciò che si trova sui fondali del Mediterraneo fa parte del patrimonio comune mediterraneo, esortare gli Stati membri dell'APM a monitorare le attività delle organizzazioni criminali e istituire a tal fine specifiche commissioni parlamentari all'interno di tutti i parlamenti dell'APM, prendendo spunto da quanto esiste nel Parlamento italiano, proporre a tutti i paesi membri dell'APM di firmare un patto regionale atto a rafforzare la cooperazione nella lotta al crimine organizzato. E mi permetto di aggiungere, senza richiamare gli allegati, gli uffici ONU, le convenzioni, cose già fatte durante la relazione del Cairo, mi permetto permetto di aggiungere anche su proposta della Grecia e del Portogallo l'istituzione di una rete informativa sulla criminalità organizzata diffusa in tutta l'area euro-mediterranea in collegamento con le varie strutture internazionali. E poi credo che sia altrettanto importante individuare delle definizioni comuni in maniera che il lavoro anche per la proposta legislativa e per il lavoro che la PM si accingerà a fare su questo tema possano queste definizioni ritrovare dei punti sui quali intervenire e discutere che siano comuni a tutti i paesi della PM. Non do lettura della risoluzione così come ha fatto il collega prima, perché agli atti e tutti quanti voi potete prenderne visione. Naturalmente chiedo l'approvazione per la PM io questa risoluzione e il progetto lo considero punto di partenza per un tema che non può lasciare indifferenti i paesi del Mediterraneo e non può lasciare indifferente anche per il ruolo che si è prefisso la stessa PM. Grazie.
Obrigado, deputada Angela Napoli. Eu colocaria, depois de ouvirmos a sua intervenção, colocava, portanto, à consideração o relatório e a resolução e, portanto, pedia que esse fosse aprovado por esta... Faz chuva. Please.
Ms. Angela, thank you for your valuable report, but I want from you to change the report on the second page. You will find at the end of the paragraph, Turkish organized crime groups are said. So to change it to organized crime groups in Turkey, because if you use Turkish, that implies the meaning of ethnicity, which is wrong, because that kind of organizations usually recruiting people from all around the world.
Muito bem, esta observação está aceita pela senhora deputada. Senhor Cuba, faz favor.
يعني ايضا شكرا للسيدة انجيلا على هذا التقرير الهام والشامل. وبالفعل يعني أنا آسف أنه كل مرة إحنا بنركز على النواقص. هذا التقرير ناقص جزء هام حيث الآثار في فلسطين، ومعروف أنه بدأ في نهبها وزير الدفاع السابق موشى ديان، واستمر هذا النهب والحفريات في الأراضي الفلسطينية ونهب هذه الآثار، وشعبنا مثل باقي الشعوب معتز بآثاره ويريد استرجاع هذه الآثار. أنا باعتقادي أنه التقرير بيكون شامل لو ذكر هذا الموضوع. النقطة الثانية حول الهجرة غير شرعية، احنا باستمرار وأخذ قرار في هذه الجمعية حول الهجرة القسرية وعدم إهمال الهجرة القسرية. كلكم تعرفون في حوض البحر المتوسط جرت هجرة قسرية، إسرائيل يعني هجرت ملايين من الناس، وصباح هذا اليوم عرض تقرير على حول اليونروا وقضية معالجة اللاجئين اللي هجروا بالقوة الهجرة القسرية. أنا باعتقادي يجب أن يكون في توازن، مثل ما في يعني عرض للهجرة العادية من دول أفريقية أو من هنا أو هناك لأوروبا، لازم إحنا نعالج الهجرة القصرية اللي جرت في فلسطين أو غيرها ضد الهجرة القصرية. شكرا.
شكرا سيد الرئيس، شكرا للسيدة الفاضلة على تقديمها للعرض. ليست لي ملاحظة ولكن لدي اقتراح. السيدة عددت الجرائم وسمتها، فسمت جريمة الاتجار بالأعضاء البشرية وجريدة تبييض الأموال وجرائم كذا إلى آخره. أنا أقترح إضافة فقرة تتعلق بالجرائم المتصلة بتكنولوجيات الاتصال الحديثة. فرغم محاربة الإرهاب في جميع أنحاء العالم، لكن هو يتطور يوم بعد يوم، ولنا لا هي تعرضت لها ولا، لكن في إشارة فقط في 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 سطر أو أقل من ذلك، يبدو أن الأمر خطير والشبكات الإرهابية العالمية تتعامل وتستغل هذه الشبكات العلمية، شبكات التكنولوجيا الحديثة في القيام بالعمليات الإرهابية وتبييض الأموال. نحن في الجزائر مؤخرا أعددنا مشروع قانون وستتم المصادقة عليه في الأيام القليلة المقبلة، فإن أردتم سأوافيكم بدراسة متواضعة أنجزت من طرف البرلمان الجزائري في هذا الاتجاه. شكرا لكم.
Kanellopoulos.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. J'aimerais évidemment féliciter Madame Napoli, mais surtout de la part de la délégation grecque, j'aimerais la remercier d'avoir inclus dans le rapport final toutes les remarques, tous les amendements que la Grèce a fait. Merci beaucoup.
Muito obrigado. Dava a palavra à Sra. Deputada Angela Napoli para fazer as considerações que entendesse.
Sim. Allora, intanto grazie a tutti per gli interventi. Per quanto riguarda il riferimento alle opere palestinesi, io accetterei il giusto richiamo, ritenendo però che non sia l'unico paese esente da questa problematica, per cui nella parte finale alla quale, della relazione alla quale faccio riferimento alla illustrazione fatta sui temi in particolare delle opere egiziane, aggiungerei un attento richiamo alle opere artistiche, ai reperti che vengono trafugati ad opera della criminalità organizzata in tutti i paesi dell'area del Mediterraneo. Per quanto riguarda invece la migrazione forzata, c'è la commissione che se ne occupa in particolare, e quindi è quella proprio sulla emigrazione. E per quanto riguarda il richiamo all'uso dei mezzi informatici da parte della criminalità organizzata, giusto richiamo, io qui ho semplicemente elencato quali sono i punti che ritengo vadano attenzionati, e tra questo c'è anche la criminalità cibernetica e la pirateria informatica. Però anche se qui figura nella relazione come semplice elencazione, io mi rendo conto, perché sono perfettamente a conoscenza dell'uso che la criminalità organizzata fa dei mezzi informatici per tantissime cose, ma in particolare per l'attività di riciclaggio. È proprio un'attività che come Commissione parlamentare antimafia in Italia stiamo trattando. Allora, quando facevo il richiamo, l'augurio che questo documento, questo progetto possa servire da base di discussione sulla lavoro della intera PAM, naturalmente mi prefiggo di aiutare ad ampliare gli argomenti e poi quando magari si istituirà una commissione, si istituiranno delle reti, vedremo come, secondo le proposte della relazione, prenderemo anche atto e consiglio, cioè la cooperazione sul tema da parte dei paesi della PM deve servire proprio a questo. Ogni paese deve supportare la discussione, le scelte che la PM andrà a fare in termini di contrasto, anche a livello propositivo, portando le esperienze, le leggi che in ogni singolo paese si mettono in atto per contrastare la criminalità organizzata.
Obrigado, deputada Napoli. Penso que estes esclarecimentos enquadraram as dúvidas que foram levantadas e, portanto, estamos agora, então, em condições de formalmente fazermos a aprovação deste relatório e da resolução que já foi distribuída por nós. E, por isso, eu perguntava se alguém se opunha. Não havendo nenhuma oposição, considera-se, portanto, aprovado este relatório e a resolução. Mais uma vez, muito obrigado, deputada Napoli. Foi um gosto tê-la connosco, tratando de problemas que interferem diretamente na vida de cada um de nós e dos nossos países. Muito obrigado. Passaria de imediato ao grupo de reflexão sobre a definição de terrorismo. Este conceito foi sempre um conceito central que deu origem a grandes discussões e que exigiu um trabalho muito, muito aturado, um trabalho muito difícil, mas que teve, digamos, um epílogo positivo. Sobre esta matéria eu não irei entrar em grandes considerações, tenho o gosto de ter ao meu lado a deputada Asquini e o deputado Cubá, que dedicaram a maior parte dos últimos meses à preparação deste relatório, fizeram de facto um bom trabalho e gostaria por isso de agradecer aos correlatores e também aos delegados para o Gabinete Antiterrorismo das Nações Unidas, que pelas informações e pela cooperação que tiveram para connosco e para com eles particularmente. Por isso, se deputado Asquim, passo-lhe de imediato a palavra.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, distinguished delegates, I would like to start out by expressing the great happiness I feel for being here in Lisbon on the occasion of significant meeting, and I greet you all with affection and respect. At the beginning, I would like to thank all the members of this assembly for their constructive comments. These contributions were extremely valuable and helped the development of the report. So let me summarize the background work and the main discussions had taken place on this report. As you know, we all agree that terrorism is becoming one of the primary problems of humanity. Combating terrorism has become the most important challenge Mediterranean countries are facing today. In order to create effective counterterrorism policies, cooperation of international actors is required. We as PAM member states believe that increasing interparliamentary cooperation in the fight against international terrorism is needed. Security and countering terrorism was always in the agenda of the first standing committee. We have been working on the subject since our first meeting of the first standing committee at 2008. During the debate on security-related issues of Mediterranean, we have found that a comprehensive convention containing an agreed definition of terrorism is much needed. Such a comprehensive text with an agreed definition will be fundamental and essential element for coping with terrorism. Me and Mr. Taysir Kuba from Palestine were appointed to be rapporteurs for this special task force. During the third meeting of the first Standing Committee on Political and Security-Related Cooperation at 18 September 2008 in Malta, I presented the report on defining terrorism. After a long and long debate, it was decided that this report needed further work and would be considered as a working document. Until its content was finalized during 2009. Mr. Suleyman Ganimat invited volunteers to join the reflection group to continue working on that report. And reflection group on terrorism had its meeting in Istanbul on 30 January 2009. This meeting was open to all members of PAM. We intended to produce collective work due to sensitivity of the subject. 10 delegates from 7 member states were attended to Istanbul meeting. In Istanbul, we heard interventions from Mr. Mahmoud Ayoub, he is UN resident coordinator in Ankara, also from Mr. Walter Geir, he is chief counterterrorism legal services section in UN, also from Mr. Sadat Laciner, he is director of International Strategic Research Organization in Turkey, also from Honorable Angela Napoli, she is with us here today, she is also member of the Anti-Mafia Committee, and we listen to also to Mr. Mutlu Köseli from Turkish Police Department, International Analyst on Terrorism. After a very constructive meeting, we convened again in Rome on 12 March 2009 in an informal setting to pursue work towards a common definition of terrorism. The Palestinian delegations were represented by the Honorable Zuhair Sanduka in Istanbul and by the Mr. Taysir Kuba in Rome. A proposal for a definition was reached in Rome and is spelled out in the draft resolution annexed to this report. So you have draft report and that explains the historical background and legitimization sources of terrorism along with a critic on their validity. Then this report clarifies the concept of terrorism and distinguishes the phenomenon from other types of crime and political violence. This report asserts the need for a common definition of terrorism and at the end, finally, provides a definition. And the draft resolution starts emphasizing several points that PAM finds them very important, such as terrorism has become one of the biggest threats to security and stability in the Mediterranean, in Europe and throughout the world. And we deeply saddened by the social and human impact that terrorist acts have caused to the peoples living in the Mediterranean region over the years. We as PAM convinced that terrorism is in itself a direct attack on human rights and the rule of law. We condemn terrorism in all its forms and manifestations committed by whomever, wherever, and for whatever purposes. I think these lines, very special lines, and will resolve most of the issues that we discussed. And as a PAM member state, we affirm that terrorism has no particular religion, race, nationality, or a specific geographic region, and that any attempt to link terrorism with any religion is not only wrong, but also plays into the hands of terrorists. We stress that no cause can justify acts of terrorism and killing of innocent people. We made special references to international conventions and UN Security Council resolutions concerning terrorism, such as United Nations Global Counterterrorism Strategy that was adopted by the UN General Assembly on 8 September 2006, and UN Security Council Resolution 1373, which was adopted in 2001. Again, here I want to thank Mr. Walter Gehr because he made very valuable contributions on the development of this part of resolution. He gave us very detailed information about the UN and international conventions on terrorism. He said that PAM, Parliamentary Assembly of Mediterranean countries, had a good ratification record with respect to those 16 conventions. International cooperation in cases falling under the 16 conventions meant that states provided mutual legal assistance in terrorism cases and that this covered prosecution and extradition. We PAM member states full compliance with the provisions of the international conventions, their protocols, and the United Nations Security Council resolutions concerning terrorism is crucial for success in countering the threat of terrorism. So under draft resolution, we made special reference to Chapter I, Article I.2 of the Charter of the United Nations. If there is occupation, of course, there is also right of people to resist occupation. Geneva and Hague conventions and protocols all deals with war crimes. International humanitarian law is the appropriate legal framework for dealing with all self-determination conflicts and for internal rebellions rising to the level of an armed conflict. Those who target military objectives in accordance with the laws of war would not be liable to prosecution as terrorists, but would be accorded combatant immunity. Any breaches of the laws of the war would be punishable as war crimes. The Hague laws and the Geneva conventions are some of the most widely applied to these international agreements. Fourth convention is relative to the protection of civilian person in time of war. Any form of physical violence or degradation to civilians is prohibited. An armed force may not attack civilians nor use them as a human shield to render a location protected from attack. According to the Hague Convention, it is illegal to attack a defenseless person or place. It is illegal to attack a building that is being used as a hospital. So again, in the report you will find in December 18, 1972, the General Assembly of the UN approved resolution on terrorism, which affirmed the right of self-determination of all people suffering from colonization, racism, and all forms of foreign domination, supporting its legal struggle launched by national liberation movements in accordance of goals, principles, and resolutions of the UN. In February 2, 1974, again, the UN approved resolution 3314 that legalized the armed struggle of peoples under foreign occupation. So we found referring to those conventions and laws will clarify all the discussion on the issue. On the draft resolution, we assert that any breaches of the laws of war must be punishable as a war crimes or crimes against humanity. We note that individuals, groups of individuals, or states carrying out acts of violence outside armed conflicts shall be punishable outside the legal framework of the laws of war for the offense committed. We note that we need to combat crimes that might be connected with terrorism, including drug trafficking in all its aspects, illicit arms trade, money laundering, and smuggling of nuclear, chemical, biological, and any other potentially deadly materials. There is need to address the conditions conducive to the spread of terrorism, as well as combating terrorism itself. All states should adopt a uniform approach for identifying, defining, condemning, isolating, and bringing to justice those who are responsible for terrorist acts. We call for increased security and judicial cooperation, including the implementation of the extradite or prosecute principle, to prevent those responsible for acts of terrorism from finding refuge. We emphasize that the fight against terrorism must be conducted with respect for human rights and the rule of law. Further, we emphasize that any person in relation to whom proceedings are taken for any terrorist act shall be granted fair treatment, including enjoyment of all rights and guarantees provided by domestic or international law, in particular international human rights, refugee law, and when applicable, humanitarian law. We convince that joint efforts by parliaments to create an international legal framework and harmonize national legislation is necessary to counter the terrorist threat spread by means of modern information systems and technologies, including the internet and the electronic mass media. We recognize that international cooperation in the fight against terrorism must comply with the principles of international law, with the respect for the territorial integrity and sovereignty of states. Again, we made special reference to the definition of former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on terrorism. He says, any action constitutes terrorism if its intent to cause death or serious body harm to civilians or non-combatants with the purpose of intimidating a population or compelling a government or an international organization to do or abstain from doing any act. This definition especially is framework for our work, and we find it very important. And as a PAM, I ask to adopt following resolution. One, terrorism can be defined as violence or the threat of violence induced by political, ideological, religious, or ethnic motives. Terrorist actions are carried out or designed to achieve maximum publicity and to produce effects beyond the immediate damage to people, property, or the environment. The methods used are extreme, destruction is ruthless, and the behavior is not constrained by the rules of war. The nature of violence is such so as to provoke fear and intimidation. And we call for acts related to terrorism to be punishable as criminal offenses in criminal law, as such in all member states, in particular on the basis of universal treaties against terrorism. Whoever perpetrated acts such as hijacking, hostage taking, should be brought to justice whether or not this person considers him or herself as a freedom fighter. This person should undergo judicial prosecution, go to jail, or to be accounted with aggravated or mitigating circumstances. So at the end, I would like to thank everybody for their contributions and for their valuable comments. And contributions were extremely helpful. And I give few minutes to my co-reporter, my colleague Taysir Kuba, because without him, this work cannot be complete. Thank you.
يعني أنا بالواقع بشكر الدكتورة أسكن على جهودها منذ أكثر من عامين للتوصل لهذا التقرير، وكانت باستمرار ملحاحة ودؤوبة للتوصل إلى هذه النتيجة، ممكن لأنها بالفعل عانت بلدها من الإرهاب. أيضا نحن، وأنا كنت كمندوب فلسطيني، كنت ملح على التوصل إلى هذا التقرير، وكنت أصر على بعض النقاط مثل الإرهاب الدولي المنظم، حيث أن الإرهاب أنواع، وبالفعل لأنه بلدي وشعبي تعرض ولا زال يتعرض لإرهاب الدولي. كما ميزنا في التقرير، وأرجو أن نكون واضحين وقد أكر، بين الإرهاب وحق الشعوب في النضال ضد المحتل. إذا هذه النقاط كانت واجدة فإحنا متفقين، وإن شاء الله نتابع هذا العمل في إسطنبول نفسها. شكرا.
Obrigado, Sr. Kubá. Vamos ter aqui, já percebi, algumas inscrições.
Madame Carrie de la France.
Faz favor. Madame Carrie de la France.
Oui, merci infiniment. D'abord, mes remerciements vont à nos deux collègues, Madame Askin Hassan de la Turquie et Monsieur Kuba de Palestine, pour le travail qu'ils ont effectué sur un sujet particulièrement difficile. Alors, nous avons, mes chers collègues, bien noté que dans la page 5 du rapport, et vous venez de le rappeler, Monsieur Kuba, le débat qui existe sur le concept de terrorisme d'État. Néanmoins, nous voulons vous faire part des réserves de la délégation française sur une interprétation d'un aspect du projet et de la résolution sur le terrorisme. Il s'agit de l'inclusion des mots et des États, entre parenthèses et des États, entre guillemets, dans le 14e paragraphe du préambule qui définit ceux qui sont passibles de sanctions pour terrorisme au titre des crimes commis en dehors des conflits armés. Nos réserves se fondent sur des considérations purement juridiques. En effet, le but de l'exercice, qui consiste à élaborer une définition internationalement reconnue du terrorisme et d'aboutir à une convention internationale prévoyant des sanctions pénales contre les auteurs d'actes terroristes. Or, il n'y a pas de responsabilité pénale des États contre lesquels on ne peut donc prononcer de sanctions pénales. En ce qui concerne le cas particulier des activités des forces armées, nous considérons que le 13e paragraphe du préambule rappelle de manière claire que toutes les actions de ces forces qui sont accomplies dans le cadre de leur mission officielle relèvent du droit international humanitaire. C'est donc dans ce cadre que les crimes de guerre et les autres crimes commis par les forces armées peuvent être réprimés. On peut certes concevoir que des crimes commis par des membres des forces armées en dehors de leur mission officielle soient considérés comme relevant du terrorisme, comme par exemple les centres de torture clandestins, comme par exemple les exécutions extrajudiciaires, comme par exemple les autres activités du type que nous avons connues comme les escadrons de la mort. Cependant, c'est alors la responsabilité pénale individuelle des auteurs de tels actes qui seraient engagés. On retrouve alors la notion, la non-responsabilité pénale des États et le fait que la mention des États dans le 14e paragraphe du préambule est donc dépourvue de portée juridique. Ces réserves faites par la délégation française, il est bien évident, compte tenu du travail qui a été effectué, que nous ne nous opposons pas à l'adoption de la résolution.
Obrigado, Madame Chiari. Dou a palavra à Sra. Deputada Ashkin para poder comentar.
Okay, thank you very much for your comment, firstly. If you look at that, I am going to read it again, noting that individuals, group of individuals or states carrying out acts of violence outside armed conflict. So I want to drive line under those words, outside armed conflicts, shall be punishable outside the legal framework of the laws of war for the offense committed. So sometimes, as we know, the states also can use the violence or the acts of terrorists. Here we are not saying or anything about the state terrorism, because it is very controversial issue, because military, I am agree that military actions by states during war are usually not considered terrorism, even when they involve significant civilian casualties. We know that the chairman of the United Nations Counterterrorism Committee has said that the committee was conscious of the 12 international conventions on the subject, and we know that none of them refer to state terrorism, which was not an illegal legal concept. I agree with you. But if states abuse their power, but sometimes they do, they should be judged against international conventions dealing with war crimes, international human rights, and international humanitarian law. I am with former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan when he said the use of force by states is already regulated under international law. But he made very clear statement. He said, regardless of the differences between governments on the question of definition of terrorism, what is clear and what we all agree on is any deliberate attack on innocent civilians, regardless of one's cause, is unacceptable and fits into the definition of terrorism. So it is a very controversial issue, but if we keep it in that way, I think it will satisfy all of us. Thank you.
Obrigado. Eu penso que há uma clarificação e penso que esta referência sugeria eu que pudesse depois constar no relatório da reunião. E penso que assim poderíamos ultrapassar o problema. Se estiverem de acordo, eu colocaria então à vossa aprovação o relatório e a resolução, perguntando se, se alguém se pronuncia contra. Não havendo votos contra, é aprovado por unanimidade. Eu agradeço. Eu.
Jordan.
Sim, Mahmoud, se for.
Shukran, Sayyid al-Rais. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. أنا أثني على جهد الأخت أسكين التي طعمت الموضوع بخبرة السيد تيسير قبعة، لكن سأتحدث بشكل عام. أنا موافق على القرار والتقرير، لكن سأتحدث بشيء يراودني بأن الإرهاب ليس مهنة، والإرهاب ليس هواية. إذن لابد من بحث الأسباب التي تدفع بالشخص أن يكون إرهابيا. فمن هو الإرهابي؟ وما هي المنظمة الإرهابية؟ إذا ما علمنا أن تصنيف الإرهاب يخضع في كثير من الأحيان لأمور سياسية وتقلبات مزاجية، فعلى سبيل المثال منظمة مجاهدي خلق كانت في يوم من الأيام منظمة إرهابية، ثم شطب اسمها من قائمة الإرهاب، ومثلها
منظمة الشين بيت في إيرلندا ومثلها منظمات كثيرة الآن ما زالت على الساحة الدولية كنمور التاميل والمورو والباسك وغيرها. ما الأسس؟ ما الأسس التي تعتمد في تصنيف المنظمات الإرهابية أو الإرهابيين؟ شكرا.
Chamar a atenção porque há dificuldades de tradução. Não está a chegar o som. Não está a chegar o som. Portanto, entretanto, eu passava a palavra à deputada Askin para comentar esta observação, se assim entendesse.
Repito.
Pode continuar?
Can I repeat?
Okay, thank you very much. The topic that you raised will be discussed in another report because the next report probably will be on the root causes of terrorism. My two reports were on defining terrorism. But the root of the what causes terrorism will be the topic of the other report. Thank you.
Muito obrigado. Penso, portanto, que está esclarecido este ponto e que estamos então em condições de considerar como aprovado o relatório e a resolução. Muito bem. Estamos a alguns minutos do fim.
5 minutos por terminar o trabalho.
Sim. Nós estamos a alguns minutos do fim e poderíamos passar, digamos, a outro ponto da ordem do dia, resumindo o resultado das reuniões que tivemos este ano e que diria desta forma, reportando-me ao meu antecessor, o Sr. Suleiman, foi presidente da primeira Comissão Permanente durante os dois últimos anos e iniciou essa tarefa afirmando que 2008 foi um período durante o qual a APM e a Comissão Permanente, enquanto braço de trabalho da organização, passaram por uma fase de aprendizagem que levou ao estabelecimento da nossa metodologia e à identificação das questões principais que merecem a nossa atenção imediata. Em 2009, do meu ponto de vista, tem sido um ano de consolidação dos nossos processos de trabalho, de consolidação do excelente trabalho que o Sr. Suleiman fez à frente da primeira comissão e a qualidade das apresentações que, aliás, nós tivemos esta manhã, confirmam que a APM, uma organização jovem, está a caminhar na direção certa e que conseguimos confirmar um papel único que desempenhamos na senda internacional. E daí que nada melhor para a afirmação de uma Assembleia como a nossa do que produzir um bom trabalho e que seja sentido por todos como bom trabalho e como um trabalho útil. Muito obrigado mais uma vez ao Sr. Cuban e à Madame Askin. E convidaria o secretário-geral Sérgio Piazzi a fazer uma pequena síntese das atividades.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would like just to say that this is the permanent commission which deals with the political affairs. So I think it's important for me to spend a few words to tell you how the Parliament, the PAM, has progressed in establishing relation with other similar partner organizations, if you wish. And of course, what has been done in full cooperation with the approval from our political bureau and in line with what was agreed last year in Monaco. Just very briefly, a major success, we have deposited the legal instrument of PAM with the legal service of the United Nations. This is a first step which will allow us, and now I have to say, I will need the help of all your ambassadors in New York to proceed with a process, a bureaucratic process, which will last about 1 year, in order to grant to PAM the observer status with the General Assembly of the United Nations. I already spoke briefly with the ambassador of Malta in New York, the ambassador of France, and I will need your help to finish that. It's a long process, because now, just to give you an idea, I have to prepare a report on the collaboration between PAM and the United Nations, and then there is something which is called the Sixth Committee, which has to make a recommendation to the General Assembly and to the Secretary General of the UN to grant such status to PAM. Then, as you remember, in Cyprus, at the meeting in Cyprus, we had the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. Now, he was very impressed by the work that PAM has done on disaster management and climate change. So now we are proceeding with an exchange of a kind of cooperation agreement between World Meteorological Organization and us, so that they can keep us regularly involved on what is the latest state of art of research on climate change and keep our assembly informed. If you remember, President Sall and George Vella have referred to the visit in Egypt and to the meeting with the Arab League. We are also working with the Arab League at exchanging a memorandum of understanding for the closer cooperation between the Arab League and PAM. Also in line with what the directive we got last year from the Bureau and from the Assembly, I have to say that, and thanks to Ashkin, who was in Bucharest a few days ago, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Black Sea has officially stated to exchange observer status with the PAM, which really allow us to expand the network of participation. Now you remember the meeting in Rome, you remember the special audience with the Holy Father, the Pope, and the meeting with the State Secretary of the Vatican, thanks to the help of the Italian delegation. Well, following that meeting, I met with the Apostolic Nuncius in Malta to see how we can get the Vatican closer associated to the activity of the PAM, because as many, especially the colleague from Arab world, said in the Vatican, we have to be sure that they participate, support the peace process, the peace effort in the Middle East. And finally, least but not last, I would say two things, sorry. First of all, you heard President Sall on the outcome of his visit in Damascus. President Sall also met with the Speaker of Qatar, which is considering applying for the associated membership with us, as Romania has already done. And President Sall also addressed the DIAD, which is the International Humanitarian Forum of the Gulf and Arab states on humanitarian action. And that was a very good forum to present the PAM to the Arab countries who do not sit in our assembly. And finally, I have received a letter from the Secretary General of the Parliamentary Union of the Islamic Conference, who also suggests to exchange observer status with the PAM, thanks to the excellent cooperation we have established. I will not mention Maghreb Consultative Council, the temporary parliament, Arab parliament, of which Mr. Kuba is also a senior president, and they are getting closer and closer with us in terms of cooperation. Mr. President, these are the latest information on the external outreach of PAM with other intergovernmental or government organizations. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado, Dr. Piazzi. Eu gostaria de apresentar agora uma lista de propostas e sugestões, recomendações, para ser utilizada como referência. E os pontos principais são os seguintes: depois de uma consulta prévia a todas as delegações nacionais, articulada, como é óbvio, através do Secretário-Geral da APM. e são 5 os pontos que se constituem sugestões. Primeiro, considerar o trabalho concluído do grupo de reflexão sobre a definição do terrorismo. 2, o grupo especial de trabalho sobre crime organizado deve centrar-se num tópico em particular, que é o crime regional e transnacional, que necessitará do nosso esforço coletivo para ser efetivamente resolvido. Poderíamos mesmo propor que as pessoas sugerissem um tráfico humano. Um terceiro ponto, que resulta de várias sugestões recebidas de vários países, no sentido de estabelecer um grupo de reflexão com o objetivo de contribuir para os esforços de diálogo que permitam uma unificação de Chipre em clima de compreensão e de consensualidade mútua. Um quarto ponto, a constituição de uma comissão ad hoc sobre o Médio Oriente, devendo continuar, portanto, a comissão ad hoc sobre o Médio Oriente deve continuar o seu trabalho. E um quinto ponto, que é organizar, juntamente com a terceira comissão permanente, uma reunião sobre a migração forçada com representantes das comunidades de migrantes forçados. As nossas reuniões ainda são caracterizadas por um debate equilibrado em que cada um de nós é livre de tomar a palavra e apresentar a sua contribuição. E agora temos de traduzir o nosso trabalho num determinado número de ações conducentes a uma agenda para 2010. O Secretariado continuará a garantir para o próximo ano o apoio de diferentes delegações nacionais para organizar as nossas reuniões. Isto serve também para melhorar o compromisso dos nossos Estados-membros em relação à APM, que só poderá continuar a sua missão se tiver apoio total por parte dos Parlamentos Nacionais. No que diz respeito à primeira Comissão Permanente, estamos a considerar as seguintes condições para 2010. O calendário provisório para 2010 é o seguinte: Síria, em fevereiro, a ser confirmado. Uma reunião conjunta dos grupos especiais de trabalho respeitantes à primeira Comissão Permanente ou respeitantes à segunda Comissão Permanente para limitarmos o número de reuniões. E a confirmação da reunião das comissões permanentes em junho, na Sérvia. A este respeito, gostaria de anunciar que na sexta-feira, dia 26, a delegação portuguesa tenciona promover um painel mediterrâneo dedicado ao comércio externo. Estão presentes o responsável da Agência de Investimento Francesa e também o responsável da Agência de Investimento Portuguesa, a Agência Nacional de Investimento. E com base na análise de hoje, vou redigir um relatório com os resultados que apresentarei à sessão plenária em outubro próximo. Com estes resultados conseguidos até agora, nós demonstramos que são produto de um esforço coletivo e recomendo por isso que na sessão plenária, após a minha apresentação do Plano Geral de Trabalho na primeira Comissão Permanente e à semelhança do que foi feito o ano passado, convido os próprios relatores para apresentar os relatórios e resoluções aprovados hoje pela nossa Comissão. Continuando com a mesma linha de pensamento em relação à sessão plenária deste ano em outubro, em Istambul, gostaria de convidar a deputada Askin Hasan, como presidente da delegação turca, para nos fornecer uma atualização das preparações para a quarta sessão plenária. E que eu penso que vou fazer apelo ao seu poder de síntese.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dear colleagues, here I would like to give you a brief information about the third plenary session. Before all, it is an honor for me to invite the whole members of our assembly to participate in this meeting on behalf of Turkish Parliament. After several consultations with Mr. Piazzi, our Secretary General, the date for the PEMS for plenary meeting determined finally as 25th October 2009. We thought this date will be the best convenient time for the members. Before and after these dates, several international assembly and platform activities are already inserted into calendar of meetings. In this way, our meeting will be held from 23 to 25th October of this year in Istanbul. As you will remember that I declared in Monaco the venue of the meeting as city of Antalya or Istanbul. Firstly, the city of Antalya seemed very attractive, but logistically it will be a little bit tiring for all to reach city of Antalya, which is in 1.5 hour far by flight from Istanbul. Actually, normally there are 3 flights daily from Istanbul to Antalya, but as you know, we are parliamentarians and I don't want any excuse to take you away from that meeting. That's why we decide that the venue of the meeting will be in Istanbul. So we promise to host you in Antalya on the occasion of one of our future meetings. At the end of third plenary meeting, for the first time, the meeting of Secretary Generals of all the member parliaments scheduled to held on the 15th October. During this meeting, all the Secretary Generals of our parliaments will find a chance to discuss the subjects which will help to conduct their office. And we decided to identify stability, prosperity and security in the Mediterranean as the main theme of the fourth plenary meeting. On the first day of the meeting, several very well-known international personalities are going to brief us on their professional missions and express their opinions about PEM's work. Several days before I came to Lisbon, as a first contact, I went to see United States diplomatic representative in our capital of Ankara. I had a warm welcome and spoke clearly about the activities of PEM. And I told them that we are considering to invite Mrs. Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State of United States, to Istanbul. They were pleased to receive such an invitation and promised to inform us if her schedule does not permit the name of another authority from Department of State will be notified us. Secondly, we wish to invite Mr. Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations, to honor our meeting. Thirdly, we prepared a letter of invitation to Mr. Bernard Kouchner, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Republic of France, who has extraordinary experience in international matters, particularly Mediterranean, Balkans and Africa. And we also invited Amr bin Musa, Secretary General of Arab League, taking into our list of guest speakers. And there will be another names. If you think that another personality will be beneficial, please let us know. We can also prepare invitation letter for them. Just before I left my hometown, we prepared those invitations, the invitation letters and other informative documents will be communicated to your parliament next month. I and my parliament will do her best to receive you in Istanbul. Thank you all.
Muito obrigado. Antes de dar a palavra ao Jorge Vela, gostaria de informar que foi aceita a sugestão da Jordânia para a constituição do grupo de reflexão sobre as causas do terrorismo. Madame Askin?
I forget very important point. So in Istanbul there will be a special event for wives of the or husbands of the parliamentarians. So please bring all your family so they will spend very good days in Istanbul. Thank you again.
Dou a palavra ao Presidente Rudi Salvo.
Oui, mes chers collègues, nous avons donc travaillé pendant une heure sur le projet de résolution présenté par Georges Vella, nous nous sommes mis d'accord, les personnes autour de la table, la délégation palestinienne en particulier, et Georges Vella et le représentant du secrétaire général et moi-même et la délégation jordanienne. Nous sommes tombés d'accord sur un texte. Ce texte va être traduit cet après-midi. Il vous sera distribué demain matin. Et donc, au moins tout le monde pourra en prendre connaissance dans la matinée. Et nous passerons au vote en début d'après-midi, mais d'une façon extrêmement rapide, puisque finalement le texte a été aujourd'hui accepté par l'ensemble des délégations présentes. Donc il n'y a plus d'aspérité concernant cette affaire.
Eu não sei se o Jorge Vella quer usar da palavra também. Quero.
Yes. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I was speaking to Mr. Aziz about the corrections we made in the resolution. No, the only thing I have to say is that I want to thank my colleagues for being very supportive and understanding. We went through a very intensive one-hour meeting under the guidance of Mr. Rudi San, and we have come to decisions as to what changes have to take place in the resolution, which I understand will be presented to you first thing in the morning tomorrow, so that we'll just read through them and vote on them. Thank you.
Bom, nós vamos então, gostaria para concluir estas nossas atividades e desta Comissão Permanente, gostaria de realçar o papel da APM como esta ferramenta de diplomacia suave, como aqui já foi tratada, quando lida, portanto, com os parlamentos, os governos e a sociedade civil da região. Neste contexto, é fundamental que todos os Estados-membros continuem a organizar as nossas várias reuniões, porque desta forma estão, digamos, a contribuir para os nossos debates com as suas perspectivas e para enfrentar os desafios que temos e que nos são comuns em todo o Mediterrâneo. E isso ajuda também a viabilizar a APM como uma realidade em toda a bacia mediterrânica. A nossa comissão é, por definição, um ator importante dentro da APM, um ator de peso, mas que só significa no conjunto de todas as outras comissões permanentes e, por isso, o nosso trabalho, ainda que importante, tem o mesmo grau de importância que o das outras comissões. E só se conseguirmos, desta forma, continuar a discutir em conjunto e focalizar a nossa atenção sobre todos os temas, é que nós poderemos obter um justo equilíbrio nas nossas reuniões. Finalmente, agora sim, gostaria de dar duas informações. É que hoje à tarde teremos uma reunião do Bureau por volta das 16 horas aqui no Parlamento e uma mais interessante, que é de que teremos um jantar aqui na Assembleia da República, oferecido pelo Presidente da Assembleia da República de Portugal, o Dr. Jaime Gama, e para o qual, como é óbvio, conto com a vossa presença. E espero também que o nosso almoço no Castelo de São Jorge, oferecido pela Câmara de Lisboa, corra da melhor maneira. Muito obrigado pela vossa colaboração, e pelas vossas sugestões, pelos contributos e obrigado a todos que intervieram na reunião. Muito obrigado. O transporte vai ser feito em carrinhas e, portanto, nós encaminhamos-nos diretamente para a porta.